Aquaman and Superman, Animal Man and Plastic Man, Firestorm and Nuclear Man, Batman and Hawkman, 2D Man and Hour Man.
Who are all these people, man?
They're all part of the DC. Who's who? Ultra Boy and Booster Gold, Lightning Lass and Hippolyta, Phantom Stranger, Etrick and Arisian, Woozy Winks.
Hey, hey, hey.
What?
What about that one guy?
What guy?
Mr. Pretzel, Mr. Lipstick, Mr. Mitzelfuzzle?
Mr. Mitzi's Pitlick?
Yeah, him.
He's also part of the DC. Who's who?
Hello, and welcome to a special episode of Who's Who in the DC Universe, covering Update 93, Issue Number 1. This is a proud member of the Fire & Water Podcast Network, and I'm one of your hosts, the Irredeemable Shag. Along with me, as always, is my co-host, the esteemed Rob Kelly. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great. What is the show again? What is this?
This is Who's Who in the DC Universe, Update 93, Number 1. That's what this show is, because the name wasn't long enough before.
Yes, yeah, seriously. We're really killing the SEO here, but okay.
Yeah, so folks, obviously it's been a while since we did our last episode. At least, well, I should be more specific. That's not true. We've actually given you a few episodes over the past year. We gave you that Teen Titans compilation episode. We hope you guys are enjoying the compilation episodes. I think they're fun. They're a neat way to look back at some of the history. We've got more of those planned in the future. We did the Who's That with Starfire, which was a lot of fun. And then we had that great Bob Greenberger interview, which was amazing. And we've got more to come, folks. You know, we're gonna do Update 93. This one, we're gonna do Issue Number 2. Yes, Frank, we are gonna cover the Impact Who's Who, but we've got a plan. Don't worry, it's gonna be entertaining. We're gonna cover the Mayfair game supplements. We're gonna do some more Who's That. We're gonna do some more flashback compilation episodes. We got a few more surprises beyond that. So the show has still got legs, and because none of us really want this train to end. I mean, we all love it. When it's over, folks. So we're finding ways to keep it alive.
Regarding Frank and the Impact, never has so much worry been had over something so insignificant.
He's sitting at home wringing his hands, gnashing his teeth.
Every episode we put out of Who's Who, he's like, but what about Impact? What is that going to be the last? I'm like, calm down. All right. We got it covered. All right. We'll be fine.
You know, we just launched four more paragraphs of comments just with this conversation right here, right? hey, you know what? There has been, I'm pretty sure since the last time we chatted, there's been news where they've announced the second omnibus for Who's Who, and it's going to include the loose leaf stuff. That's crazy. Like, I don't even think it's the right same dimensions as a comic book page. So I'm just interested to see how they're going to lay that out. It should be fascinating.
That's interesting. I think you're right. I think they're a little taller than they are than a comic. Well, maybe not. I don't know.
Well, just, yeah. if you cut off the holes, you know, the punched holes, maybe it works out. I don't know. It'll be
proportionately, it's probably okay.
It's pretty close, yeah. So, we'll tell you what, folks, why don't we get into this before we jump into the comic? We've got some other stuff to talk about. We do need to take a second to thank our sponsors. Folks, this episode of Who's Who is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping for orders of $50 or more. What'd you bring, bud?
I am recommending a Legion of Superheroes book, not a hoax, not a dream, not an imaginary tale. No, because this book is so Legion heavy. I thought let's pick something from the Legion. I went with Legion of Superheroes Before the Darkness, hardcover volume 2. I thought that was a Morrissey album. It reprints Legion of Superheroes numbers 272 through 283, DC Special Series 21, and the Best of DC Blue Ribbon Digest number 24,
wow.
360 pages. It features a gorgeous cover by George Perez, redundant. Of course, it features stories written by Jerry Conway, Roy Thomas, and of course, Paul Levitz, and then interior art by Jim Janes and Steve Ditko and others. I didn't read these issues of the Legion, but the cover, again, by George Perez, I remember this cover. I don't remember what issue it's from, but I remember seeing it on the newsstands, and I almost bought it because the cover is so great. You've got all these Legionnaires, and there's like they're pulling a mask off of Reflecto. I don't know what any of this means, but it looks really cool. Anyway, the normal price is $49.99. In stock trades price is $28.99. That is 42% off.
Now, the name means in that one, because I did look at the one that you put in there. It's the Great Darkness Saga.
Right, like I know the Great Darkness Saga. Yeah. Yeah, I know that, yeah.
So this is right before that. So I first thought it was going to be collecting all the stuff. Before the Darkness, meaning before the 5 year later stuff is what I thought they meant. And I thought that'd be perfect pick for you, right? But no, it's right before the Great Darkness Saga. So it's good stuff.
Okay.
I picked something related to the very first entry in the book. The first entry in the book is a Flash entry, or Flash-related entry, I should say. So I thought, all right, so what is some of my favorite Flash stuff? And the Mark Waid, Mike Waringo era of Flash is an absolute joy for me. So I picked a Flash by Mark Waid, trade paperback, book four. And this is a great era, because by this point, Flash has brought in all the other speedsters as the supporting cast. It's got, you know, obviously Wally. It's got Impulse. It's got Jay Garrick. It's got Jesse Quick, Max Mercury, all these characters as regular supporting characters. Art by Mike Waringo. This is right after Zero Hour. This collects, in fact, Flash number zero, part of that Zero Hour collection. And then issues 95 to 105 and Flash Annual number 8 is 368 pages. They're dealing with Cobra in this one. They're dealing with Impulse. You know, quite frankly, the story doesn't matter. It's Mark Waid and Mike Waringo. It's good stuff. If you've never read the Mark Waid Flash, you know, I recommend you start with the first one. But if you had to dive anywhere, this would be a great one simply because of the teams involved with the characters and the creators. So a full color normally goes for $34.99, but you can get it for 42% off. So only $20.29. That's a great deal for 368 pages of Mark Waid and Mike Waringo. I mean, that is some gorgeous, gorgeous stuff. So, folks, for these and all your other trade paperback needs, please visit instocktrades.com. Now, this episode is also sponsored in part with your help from home through Patreon. Because, you know, running the Fire and Water Podcast Network with so many shows requires a lot of online hosting and, you know, other services that come along with that. And a while back, we realized we needed some help with the expenses. And you guys really helped us out when we launched the Patreon. You stepped up and helped keep the network going. So if you're enjoying the Who's Who podcast, the best way to support our show is by visiting our Patreon. And what's that URL, Rob?
Patreon.com/FW podcast.
And while you're there, please consider supporting the Firewater Podcast Network. In a certain tiers, you'll get mentioned on shows of your choice, just like these people who ask to be recognized on the Who's Who podcast like once a year. So our thanks go out to
Chuck Coletta, Christopher M. Leiden, Corey Drew, Gord Tolton, Jeremiah Jones Goldstein, Michael O'Brien, Paul Kenzel, Steve Givens,
Tom Perrin, David Ace Gutierrez, Mike Atchison, Damian Whiter, Nathan Archer, Noah Tarnow, Tom Panner Reese. Again, folks, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FW podcast. All right, so you remember, go out on the social medias. You can find us on Twitter, we're FW Podcast. On Facebook, it's the Fire and Water Podcast Network. We are going to post some images to our gallery. Again, I'm trying to do less images now that they're reprinting these things. I don't want to do too many because, quite frankly, they're going to be available again for the first time in a million years. When we started the show 11 years ago, we didn't think they would be. Or 9 years, whatever it is. Anyway, so we are going to dig into this. We ready to go, Rob? Am I forgetting anything?
No, I'm dying to talk about all these Legion entries.
I bet you are. I bet you are. I'm a little rusty, so forgive me. But we are here to talk about Who's Who in the DC Universe, update 1983, number one. Cover price of $5.95. Now, that is an increase of a whole dollar over the previous iteration of the Loose Leaf Who's Who. So I guess they had to get their money back. Cover dated is December 1992. It was on the shelves November 3rd, 1992. So you could buy this, Rob, and read it all the way through Thanksgiving break. You know, it'd be fun. Now, it had been 10 months since the previous iteration of Who's Who, the 16-issue run, 10 months since that one ended. So a lot of things have happened to the DC Universe. A couple things worth noting here. Bob Cahan is the new editor, so that's changed up. Michael Urie is no longer the editor at this point. And across the top of the issue number one says, you know, what's new in the DC Universe? You know, there's a real missed opportunity here. They could have just said, what's new in the DCU? That would have been great, right, with the rhyming. But all right, we'll forgive you. And the cover is Rob's beloved Legion. We're not going to talk about it now because it's just a reproduction of the interior art. So we will get to that. Any comments before we get inside, sir?
Okay, yeah, at the top of the show. I mean, when I look through this book in preparation for this episode, my initial reaction to most of the listings was extreme. I mean, this is just the most extreme issue of Who's Who imaginable. Every character that I might have been familiar with has been turned into a 90s Mountain Dew commercial version of themselves. So I want to spare everybody by making that same joke 26 times throughout this episode. So I'm just going to get it out of the way now. I'm just going to say it. I've said my piece. This is so 90s. This is like the 90s 90s possible issue of Who's Who. Now, I haven't looked at number two in a while. Maybe number two is even worse. I don't know. But for now, this thing is more 90s than you dressing as Kid Eternity. I mean, it's just amazing. So I just want to get that out of the way now. And then secondly, I know hardly any of these characters, so I will not be saying much, which I think is going to make this Shag's favorite episode of the Who's Who series.
Now, all right, I will, as we go through this, I'm actually going to challenge you on some of these, because a lot of these entries, I don't feel look as, like, I was expecting 90s extreme, right? I was expecting to be like, this is like, you know, the 90s stuff that makes my skin cringe. That actually doesn't come out till about 95 is when that gets really, really bad. So at this point, I think there's a lot of images in here that are kind of classic. I mean, not all of them. And we'll point out the ones that are bad. I mean, we're not going to pull any punches here. But I think it's a lot better than I was expecting. And it's also fair to say this is extremely timely. I mean, the point of this is to talk about stuff that's brand new in the DC universe. And as I go through this, I'm going to point out that a lot of these characters, their first appearance is here before they even make it to the comic. I mean, that's how timely this stuff is. They are right on the cusp of this. So that's another thing, too. As I'm kind of going through the histories of the characters, understand that a lot of this was evolving. So the history I'm going to read you is coming from the entry. It might have changed in the next month's comic because the stuff's still so fresh. So if it sounds like I've got something wrong, I didn't. I'm getting it from the entry, or maybe I was drunk when I read it. I don't know, whatever. But so yeah, it's very much of its time. So anyway, we'll get into this. You know, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. Okay. All right. We've said our piece.
Good. Now, guys, you won't hear Rob for an hour. It's gonna be awesome. So as I said on the inside, we get the introduction of the new editor. So welcome, Bob Cahan. We've still got Arlene Lowe on as copy editor, though. So that's a good thing. Now they do explain on the inside cover. They say what they're expecting is going to be every year new updates that'll be two or three issues, and they also kind of talk about other stuff they had in mind. None of which will come to fruition, people. This is going to be the end of the loose leaf edition here. Well, I mean, there's Impact and stuff like that, but as far as the traditional yearly Who's Who, what's going to happen is it's going to transition from here to like the DK books. It's going to transition to the DC encyclopedias. It's going to transition to the Secret Files. So interesting. So let's enjoy this ride as we go, folks. First entry is the most 90s entry in the book, though. So, I mean, it's right out of the gate. This is unfortunate that alphabetically this character had to go first. It is Abracadabra, the Flash villain, drawn by Greg LaRocque and Jose Marzan. Not that you would know it's Abracadabra without the name there. This is very much during the 90s period where he had suffered some tragedy. So it's showing him, he's hulking over, like hunched over. There's flames all around him. He's literally on fire, and his face is scarred horribly from being burnt in the fire, and his clothes are tattered. Rob, let her rip.
No. Like I said, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to yell extreme because it's just, that's going to be doing that every entry. This thing made me laugh, though, the first time. The first entry, I was just like, this is everything superhero comics was in the early to mid-90s. Obviously, you know, you think about when these characters are created, especially Abracadabra, right? It mentions his first appearance is Flash number 126 from May 1962. So that's a full 30 years before this book came out. And back then in the 60s, when John Broom and those other writers were writing, you know, magicians were like a big part of the entertainment, you know, universe. You know, that was like weightlifters and bodybuilders and like that, you know, that was so it made sense that you could almost make a magician but make him a bad guy. Oh, that's fun. But by the 90s, magic was kind of really out. You know, I mean, there are still some magicians. And like, this is right. Like, you know, you have like the David Copperfield and like the David Blaines of the world. And I think this is a little bit before those guys.
Yeah. This would be after Doug Henning and after David Copperfield, but before David Blaine. So it's really kind of like maybe a Lance Burton.
Right in the midpoint before it's like magic was like, oh, we're cool guys. You know, that kind of thing. So it makes sense that you're going to take this character who now looks very quaint and try and do something with him to beef him up a little. So that makes total sense. That said, this just made me laugh. This guy who is so not threatening, and they're just trying so hard. Like, so many of these entries remind me of that meme of Steve Buscemi from 30 Rock. You know, hello, fellow kids. It's just that kind of like, they're so desperate trying to make this look hip, and it's Abracadabra. I mean, his name is Abracadabra.
I know.
You know, how hip can it get? And then one other observation I will make about this one and many other entries in the book. You and I have been doing this show long enough that in the early And in the early days, though, when one of the characters' listings, we got to a character who had appeared in live action, right?
Yeah.
That was worth noting.
Right.
That was worth noting. And now, like, 75% of the characters, like in this book alone, have been transferred into live action. It's just like, that's just amazing how much it's changed. That, like, you know, in 2013, we were like, ooh, this guy made a cameo in one episode of Lois and Clark. That's worth noting. And now it's like, oh yeah, Abracadabra, he was on Flash for like four seasons, right? Amazing how much has changed in just the lifespan of this podcast.
I'm glad you brought that up, because specifically, you know, I do that research, right? This is one of the few characters I didn't even bother to look up, because I'm just like, eh, he was probably in the Flash TV show. So I literally, my note says probably in the Flash TV show. I didn't even look, because he had to be, right? How could they miss that? So all right. So bouncing off of what Rob said, the whole point of why Abracadabra's in this issue is because the update, really, of what's happened to him here is his scarred face. You know, he's been horribly burned. He's a burn victim now. And they've really changed his backstory. Or I should say they've enhanced his backstory. I mean, he's always been like a criminal from the future, right? From the 64th century. Well, here, what we've uncovered in the recent months or years, whatever, is that he's in the 64th century, the world was very, very controlling. Everything was sanitized. Everyone were basically a cog in the great machine, controlled by this entity, group, whatever, called Cronark, like Monarch, but Cronark. And Abracadabra in that future, his name was Citizen Abra. And he was a madman. He was crazy. And he resisted. And he was championing, whew, that's a tough word apparently, individuality. And he actually was, you know, he wasn't a good person, but what he was doing was actually helping society by trying to get people to be individuals. Well, for his crimes, he was exiled to the 20th century. Well, that's where the rest of the history that we all know fits in. You know, he fought Barry Allen, he was there all the time, he used magic, all that stuff. Well, they're saying now that, you know, all that would still happen. And here in the modern era, well, he was battling Wally West one time. Abracadabra got caught in this horrible fire explosion, which scarred him horribly, drove him insane, and now he goes on to fight Wally West on a semi-regular basis as a recurring villain. And at one point, they did return to his future, and Wally fought alongside him and freed the people of the 64th century from the Cronarchs, but then Abracadabra had to come back to 20th century and served out some jail time. So they tried to give him an update, tried to update his backstory, and tried to make him, you know, like you said, get away from the goofy thing and make him more of a tragic character by being burned. This image doesn't sell any of that, but... First appearance, as you said, Flash 128, May 1962. The writer of this entry is Mark Waid, so you know it's well written. Border is black. And, you know, they talk about his powers and things like that and where he gets them from, and, you know, all the magician stuff. Now they say he doesn't have any of that, and he's cobbling together stuff he can find from jail. So at this point, Flash was on number 72, well into the Mark Waid run. So, all right.
Oh, wait a minute. Before we get off this,
oh, yeah.
I did some research. Abracadabra did, in fact, appear on the Flash TV show in an episode he had. It was titled Abracadabra.
Okay.
Played by David Dastmalchian or Dastmalchian. I don't know how you pronounce that.
Okay.
Now, do you know what other famous comic book role Mr. Dastmalchian played?
Considering you can't even pronounce his name, I don't know who we're talking about.
Polka Dot Man in the Suicide Squad.
Oh my gosh.
So this guy has played Abracadabra and Polka Dot Man. So there you go, everybody.
So clearly this guy has a who's who at home, and he's like just looking for the most obscure characters he can audition
there
for.
There you go.
Awesome. All right. Up next is Agent Liberty. So this is a very patriotic hero. So what we're looking at here is the art's by Dan Jurgens and Jackson Geist, by the way. So it's a man flying through the air with a jetpack, and he's facing us, and he's got, like, on one arm, he's got this glowing force field shield. The other hand, he's holding a pistol. His bodysuit is black. He's got yellow boots, yellow belt. He's got a very patriotic-looking cross. I don't know what you call those. Like, Martian Manhunter wears them, like cross strips across his chest. I don't know what you call that. You're not helping.
Hawkman gear, basically.
There we go. Yep. And he's got a yellow cowl. And of course, you know, it's the 90s. So he's like, rah! He's kind of like yelling. Behind him is the Statue of Liberty. And then, like, this really badass helicopter. So, Rob, without knowing anything about this guy, probably, what do you think of the image?
I mean, it's good. The artwork's perfectly fine. Dan Jurgens and Jackson Geist. That's, you know, solid. I wasn't reading Superman at this time. So other than this listing, I don't know anything about him. I mean, yes, he's in front of the Statue of Liberty and he's holding a gun. That is very American. I like the artwork and what I read about it. It's weird to me that, like, it seems like from some of the listings that we went over on the loosely, like, they were bringing in a lot of supporting characters into the Superman books that were not villains, but, like, other heroes.
Yep.
That's kind of interesting to me that, like, Superman had this coterie of supporting characters. What was the other guy? Like Crime Smasher? Whatever the guy's name was?
Crime, there's Gangbuster.
Gangbuster. Yep. And then it was Guardian, you know, yep. That's just interesting to me that there were Superman had all these other guys around him when he's Superman. He doesn't, you know, like.
Well, they were putting out 4 books a month. So
yeah, there you go. Right. I guess so. That was, yeah.
And you got to be careful with Superman villains too, because if you make them powerful enough to really take on Superman, like toe to toe, then you're talking about like a world shaker, and how many world shakers can you really have out there? So yeah, they really did a lot of developing supporting characters. And this is one, and I'll tell it right out there, folks. I love this guy. I really enjoyed this character, not necessarily everything they did with him, but I enjoyed the concept behind him. So the deal here with Agent Liberty is he's basically a black ops, like super soldier agent kind of guy. He's former CIA, now a soldier of fortune. He joined this secret black ops patriotic organization called the Sons of Liberty. Let's not make this political because that's going to get out of hand if we do. He's got this gear of like the jetpack and armor and the force shields. He's got these like gauntlet blades and he's an experienced fighter and an espionage agent. But so Agent Liberty, he ends up fighting alongside Superman several times. And then this group he's part of, the Sons of Liberty, though, they go very, very dark and they start doing political assassinations. So Agent Liberty has to like, you know, battle against them. And then he goes out on his own, separate from the soldiers of Sons of Liberty. And basically, he was designed to be DCA's patriotic badass, is what he was supposed to be. He could have been great. He could have been like, you know, kind of a Captain America with the gun kind of guy. But DC didn't invest in him terribly. I mean, Dan Jurgens put a lot of effort into it. In fact, 11 months prior to this, he had his own special, Agent Liberty Special Number 1, which I think had that, what, a fifth color metallic cover ink or whatever the heck it was in the 90s, right? So do you feel like this image screams 90s? I feel like this image screams 80s, and maybe that's because of Dan Jurgens.
This feels actually a little more – this feels a little 80s kind of thing, you know, okay. John Byrne sort of Superman.
Yeah. So Agent Liberty would show up from time to time in the Superman books, and this is kind of interesting. You know, everyone's made it to TV, right? So is this guy. But they adapted him very loosely as like a villain for a whole season arc of Supergirl. It's really – Not a lot of it survived. What this character was, the Sons of Liberty was in it, and things like that. It wasn't a one for one development, but at least you know the idea was out there, so people have heard of it at least. So first appearance is Superman number 60 from October 1991. The writer of this entry is Roger Stern, so you know it's good. The border is red for Hero, so there we go. That's Agent Liberty. I like the guy. And there's been several Agent Liberties after this, if I remember correctly. So, he gets the creator credit created by Dan Jurgens.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So, all right, next one, Azrael by Joe Quesada and Kevin Nolan. So, whatever happened to that Joe Quesada guy? I don't think he ever went anywhere. All right. So, on the cover here, you've got if you're not familiar with Azrael, maybe you just know Azbats or whatever. So, he's got this red. Well, it's kind of hard to see because he's crouching, really. But he's got a red costume with like a not a jerkin. What do you call that? Like a the thing that hangs loosely over your front. Yeah.
I have no idea.
Okay. Anyway, so he's got like the thing, the fabric that hangs loosely. It's got the fleur-de-lis on there. He's got this black mask with a red sort of face area and a white glowing eyes. But the big feature of him, though, he's got these giant gauntlets and these huge flaming like swords or triangles are coming up out of the gauntlets. And they look totally badass because it's Joe Quesada. The man can draw. So there's all these flames that are, and with almost looks like sparking electricity almost too, but just flowing out of his gauntlets. And behind him is this giant old ancient seal of the Order of Dumas that looks, you know, very medieval kind of Templar Knight sort of thing. And he's got the Azrael logo above it. So what do you think of this image, buddy?
Oh, it's great. It's great drawing. You didn't mention it's inked by Kevin Nolan.
Oh, I thought I did. If I didn't, I'm sorry.
Okay. Yeah. Which I'm not that familiar with him doing a lot of inking work, not of his own pencil. So
yeah, good point.
An interesting combination. It's a nice image. I mean, this is about to say, this is what I'm about to say is a ridiculous nitpick, and it's not even wrong. It's just an artistic choice as a graphic designer. This is the way my eye goes to things. So you've got the Azrael logo, right? And at the bottom of the Azrael logo, it's got a very particular curve. The A is L's, you know, bow out. And then you've got this seal behind him and this circle. And the circle doesn't follow the curve of the Azrael logo. It's not wrong. It's an artistic choice. But just to me, it's like, oh, it would have looked so cool if the curve had been exactly the same as the logo. Now, of course, they would have had to – the logo is the logo. So they would have had to change the background image to fit the logo's curve. But, like, just when I look at it, my eye just goes, ah, why is it? Why does it look like that? I don't know.
Well, at this point, this is probably still paste up. You know, I would think in 92, maybe I'm wrong.
Probably. Yeah.
So I, you know, give it a couple of years. If this had been in Photoshop, yeah, they would have just skewed the Azrael logo to make that arch. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. Again, it's not wrong. I'm just being ridiculous. By the way, it mentions the first appearance, since his first appearance of Sword of Azrael, remember, which is funny, Sword of Azrael.
Yep.
Is that where he went down and fought those micro people with the frogs and stuff like that? Oh, that was Sword of Azrael. I had no idea that he first appeared in his own book. I thought he appeared in Batman. Like, I thought he was. I always thought he was a Batman character that, like, grew to be really popular. I didn't know that he started off under his own title, even though it was a miniseries. I had no idea.
So, all right. So, I've got that story to tell. I was, my only nitpick I was going to say on the art on the cover, though, is just I do wish Azrael was standing up, because it is sort of hard to see his costume, the way he's crouching. Like,
yeah,
that.
He's pretty tiny in the overall image.
Yeah. So, yes. Yeah, so here's the interesting thing. So, we talked about, you know, how I mentioned earlier how some of these are very, very, very current. So, Sword of Azrael number one, October 1992 was his first appearance. The comic is still on issue number three right now. So it's a 4-issue miniseries that's not even over yet when this entry came out.
Oh, I thought you meant now as of 20.
No, no, I'm sorry. Oh, no.
Wow, that's late. Holy.
Yeah, Joe Quesada draws really slow.
Yeah, Kevin Smith writing it? What's going on?
Oh, well, you know, them together. Anyway, so that's how contemporary this is. I mean, literally, they're still telling this story. So the entry here is a lot of actually mostly backstory rather than what's actually going on the comic. And yeah, so Sword of Azrael. All right, well, let me tell you the history, then I'll tell you about the comic. How's that, if that's okay? Sure. Actually, I'm not going to ask your permission. I'm just going to do it.
Yeah, I know.
So,
I weirded out. I was like, why are you even asking me?
On the back, it says created by Denny O'Neill and Joe Quesada. And which is sort of interesting, too, is that I was reading online. Apparently, Peter Milligan also helped create Azrael, but doesn't get credited, which is a weird thing. Yeah, I don't know what that's about. So, he was a new character who was introduced in Sword of Azrael number one. And the way the story goes, they're introducing the centuries-old legacy of Azrael's, similar to the Knights Templar. It's called the Order of St. Dumas. And the Order was around for a long time and eventually went into hiding and managed to become insanely rich. They're some of the richest people on the planet. And there's this legacy of this avenging angel called Azrael, which is passed down from father to son. And a lot of times the training was done secretly where the person wasn't even aware they're being trained. They were hypnotized during the training, so they weren't even aware they're being trained. So the most recent Azrael at this story, when Sword of Azrael number one begins, was going after an embezzler within the Order. And the Azrael ends up getting mortally wounded. And just before he dies, he passes on the mantle of Azrael to his son, Jean-Paul Valley, who we all know is Azrael and Azbats and all that stuff. So what basically this entry is telling us is the setup for the Sword of Azrael miniseries. The series itself tells all, you know, I can't remember. I think most of this is unveiled in the first issue. I don't remember for sure. But so, you know, a lot of his adventures aren't even chronicled here, which is kind of cool. So you said exactly what you said. This book comes out, right? It was a miniseries. I'm pretty confident Batman was in it. I haven't read it in many, many years. I've got the trade on the shelf. I guess I could pull
it out.
Was it
a 90s comic? Yes, Batman. Okay.
And Denny O'Neill wrote it. I mean, come on. So, but no one, and I was working in a comic shop at this time, right? None of us expected anything. You know, it's another miniseries. Oh my gosh, DC's cranking out a million miniseries. No one expected this thing to do anything. But a combination of Batman, Denny O'Neill, and Joe Quesada caused this thing to explode. It was one of these series that got reprinted immediately after it was done being published, which didn't happen that often back then. So it's quite shocking how explosive it was. I don't know the full history, and I'm sure one of you people at home do. I don't think they had already planned to make Jean-Paul Valley Batman when they introduced him. I think that came very shortly afterwards, maybe when they found out just how popular he was. I do not think that was in the cards right away, but it happened not too long afterwards. So another example of how early this is in the career, you know how they have all the different sections for the characters. There's not even a section for powers and weapons here.
No.
And there's a proofreading error in this.
I know. Damn it, Arlene Lowe. Damn
right.
It.
So you saw it, right?
Yeah, gave his secrets to his son, who vowed to use them in a quest for his father's murderer.
Oh, that's a typesetting error. Okay, yeah. Good point. I didn't care. I'm talking about proofreading. Go over to the first column. There's about towards the bottom of there, it talks about they came into conflict with Pope XXX and King XXXX. Clearly, those are placeholders.
Oh, God. Yes, you're right. That's
so
right.
Denny must have wrote that with placeholders, and no one caught that they didn't replace them.
Oops.
I do that in work all the time when I'm writing emails or
that
memos.
My eyes just blurred, just kind of grazed right over there. You're right. King yep. XXX. It's the
so
X-rated king. Okay. Wow. Oh, wow. Oh, man. Geez. Okay.
So we all know where it goes from here. You know, Jean-Paul Valley ends up becoming the next Batman. And the whole purpose of that story was to show you, like, everyone wanted, you know, 90s dark, dark, dark. So they said, okay, fine. We'll give you a 90s dark Batman and you're going to hate it. And unfortunately, a lot of people liked it. but so that's where we got Azbats from. So here's a thought. So Azrael's appeared in the Gotham TV show. He's appeared in a crap ton of video games, right? But he's, as far, unless I'm mistaken, folks, he's never been in a movie, maybe in an animated thing, I don't know, but never really in a movie. Like, they've told the Nightfall story with Bane, right? They did that last Nolan movie all about that and stuff like that. They've done Nightfall animated stuff, but they've never told the other half of it. They've told about the fall of Batman and coming back up, but they've never told the part about where Azrael becomes Batman. Like, that just seems like it's tailor-made for a Batman movie. I'm shocked they've never done this.
Yeah, I mean, they should make an HBO Max series at this point. Why not?
Well, they probably will. That's a good point, yeah. So, all right, written by Denny O'Neill, art by Joe Quesada and Kevin Nolan. Border is red for hero. We've talked about all this. So, again, it's on issue number 4. Now, interesting, you know, Azrael, after the whole Batman stuff, goes on to get his own series that goes on for 100 issues. You know what that is, right?
25 more than Aquaman's ever done.
Thank you. You finished my punchline. Boom. Just like we planned it. All right.
By the way, occupation, security thug.
Oh, interesting.
Which is a judgment call. Calling someone a thug is a judgment call.
That's fair.
Okay, Denny O'Neill.
I guess at that point, Denny had earned the right. So, all right, up next is Black Condor, but not the one you're expecting. This is Ryan Kendall. So on the cover here, it's drawn by Rags Morales. Let's see, is there an inker? Is it? No, it's just Rags on his own. So it's Rags Morales drawing a man who, and I was never clear on this, he looks like he's of Native American descent. I'm not entirely sure, but he is flying through the air. He's got large wings that go underneath his arm. They connect from like his wrist all the way down to his hip, and they're red, giant red feathered type wings. And he's flying across the cityscape. He's being lit from below, and he's throwing a knife, not quite at the camera, but just slightly off camera. And it's got the Black Condor logo. I will admit the pose is very 90s, but what do you think of the art here?
It's good. Anatomy wise, I'm a little like his arms are like the length of his leg. Basically, if you look, and I know the Rags Morales is trying to do foreshortening, and foreshortening is very hard to do. He's doing it a couple places here with the arms and then the knife that's being thrown. So it's pretty good. It's just, you look at the arms, you're like, my God, he'd be dragging his knuckles on the ground. His arms are large. I will give credit, however, to the fact that his base of operations is Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
Which is unusual. And in the background are two buildings from the Philadelphia landscape.
Oh, really? Okay.
The PNB building and Independence Hall are to the right there. Those are buildings in Philadelphia. So good for you, Rags Morales. That's some verisimilitude.
I will scratch through my note about the peanut butter skyscraper in the background then. Yep. I thought there was a J missing off that tower. Okay.
Nope, that's what it says in the building.
All right. Well, I like this art because I loved the Black Condor series. I love the lighting that he's clearly being lit from below. I thought that was very
cool.
Effective because it's being done in the colors and in the inking. It's a combination of that. He's got kind of the glowing green eyes. And yes, the anatomy is wonky, but if you assume there is some exaggeration, like you're not trying to think he's trying to go for, you know, a perfect body. He's trying to go for, you know, the impressionistic kind of style. I go with it. And we all know where Rags Morales is going with his career. I mean, this is his early days. This guy is going to be one of the greatest superstars in comics. So I love it. Again, I was a mark for it because I like the series. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say, I do say, again, not to be nitpicky, but like the his logo has one too many graphic design elements. Just one too many. It's not bad, but you've got two different fonts and then the red triangle and the orange border and then the little motion lines. And it's like, I just feel like it's just one too many. Just simplify it just a little bit.
You hate so many things I love. All right. So here we go. So Ryan Kendall, which is all right, interesting thing here. Alter ego, it says Nun, and yet in the history, they tell us his name is Ryan Kendall. Oops, that's a little bit of a mistake. But so created by Brian Augustine, and who just passed away recently, sadly, and Rags Morales. And the story is another secret cabal. You're going to hear that a lot in this episode, by the way. There's a lot of secret cabals in the 90s in DC Universe. So this one's been around about 200 years. It is the Society of the Golden Wing. And they are their goal was always to try and create a flying man. And they started off kind of not horrible, but by the time they get to the 2000 or you know the 1990s, they were really sick, twisted people. They're using radiation and mutation and chemicals and all these things to try and bring about a flying man. Well, they were finally successful with this young man, Ryan. At 21 years of age, after being experimented on all this time, they finally were successful. However, it put him into a coma. So he was in a coma for 2 years. But he was completely aware of his surroundings. So he heard everything around him. So he heard everything about the Society of the Golden Wing and how they were horrible and doing terrible things. So when he comes out of the coma, he just bolts. He gets out of there. And he goes to, and this is where I need your geographic expertise. He goes to a place called the New Jersey Pine Barrens, supposedly the largest national forest in the United States. Is this a thing?
Well, the Pine Barrens, certainly that's where the Jersey Devil supposedly lives. It's the Pine Barrens. You've heard of the Jersey Devil, right?
No.
You've never heard of the Jersey Devil?
I really? Assumed it was like some sibling of yours. No.
But up, bump, bump. No, the Jersey Devil is a local, you know, like our local version of Sasquatch.
That kind of thing.
It's this monster that lives in the Pine Barrens. So yes, the Pine Barrens is an actual real place.
Okay. Well, there we go. So he lives there. And he was a hermit for quite a while after escaping this group. But he eventually befriends a park ranger. And eventually, they sort of learn to control his savagery. And he becomes a reluctant hero. So he doesn't really want to be a hero, but he keeps getting dragged into it. And his powers are all driven mostly by like mental powers, like telekinesis. That's how he flies, his telekinesis. The telekinesis also helps protect his, gives him sort of tough skin, uses telekinesis to make him stronger. So he's got the strength of five men. I like that sort of quantifier, strength of five men. He's got tracking and he's other powers that are developing as you go along. First appearance is Black Condor number 1, which is June 1992. And they're only on issue number 8 at this point. So he's still another relatively new character. The entry here is written by Mark Waid. I'm kind of surprised I didn't get Brian Augustine to write it, but there we go. And the border is red for hero. So for me, you know, at this point, oh, by the way, in the inset pictures, you've got him in a tree. You've got him. That's the shark that he's fighting, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Funny.
And then he's there with his friend, the park ranger. And the park ranger's reading the newspaper and it says, "Riots!"
So, that's a funny inset. That has like a real I'm with stupid kind of energy to it.
It does. It does. So, you know, we've got Black Condor, right, on the shelves. We've got the Ray on the shelves, which we'll hear about next issue. We know Phantom Lady's been around since the mid-80s, you know, in the post-crisis universe. We've seen multiple versions of the Atom by this point. Now, not Dom. I know the connection would be Doll Man, but, you know, shrinking people. We've got multiple versions of the Atom at this point in DC Universe. I don't think Damage was around just yet. But Damage was coming, which is essentially the human bomb. I mean, as fans, I loved what DC was doing. It's like, okay, they are clearly building, almost like the MCU did. They are building towards something. They're introducing these individual characters, building up hopefully a popularity, and then we'll then bring them together as the Freedom Fighters. I loved it. I was dying for it. You know, in fact, I remember thinking, okay, you know, they're not going to get Uncle Sam. I didn't think they would get Uncle Sam. So I'm like, they could use Agent Liberty. You know, he's kind of your patriotic guy. So either way, I was so excited for this. I was waiting, desperate for them to put together the Freedom Fighters. They kind of sort of never did, but then they kind of did. Like, they never got it the way we wanted. They just did it offhandedly, would mention, oh, there's a Freedom Fighters team now. And of course, this is after most of their comics were canceled. They didn't turn out to be the stars we all hoped. And then they just wiped them all out in Infinite Crisis to make way for a new set of Freedom Fighters. So I never got the Freedom Fighters I really wanted, and I'm disappointed it never happened.
Hmm. The creator credit, as you mentioned, Brian Augustine, mm-hmm. and Rags Morales, this really does underscore like the stickiness of crediting creators properly, because yeah, this character was created by those two guys, but like there was a Black Condor
that's
before
true.
This who flew, you know what I mean? Now, like there's no, now I don't, it doesn't mention him in this listing.
No, and there's no connection.
There's
with
no connection. That, okay.
Yeah.
But nevertheless,
the very, very different.
It's like, okay, yeah, they didn't, I mean, yes, they created Black Condor, but they didn't create, you know what I mean? It's like,
yeah.
It's like me saying, hey, I created a character called Batman. Yeah. He's like,
right.
He's completely different than the other Batman, but yeah, but it's still Batman. You know what I mean? So
Bat-Man.
Yeah. I mean, again, no disrespect meant to Mr. Augustine and Morales. It's just funny that it's so complicated about like, well, do we give Lou Fine kind of credit? Cause he did the first Black Condor. I don't know. Like, all right, fine. You know,
it's almost like they should have done what they used to do. It was like put Black Condor 2. On the name or something
like
that.
Yeah.
And boy, we're going to get to a big one in a little while here that I got a real burr up my butt about. So yeah, right in that line. I know it's so stupid to get worked up about.
Wonderful
this
visual.
All right, up next is Black Mask by
here
Tom Mandrake.
Go. Oh yeah, now we're
this
talking.
This is going to be interesting. All right, so Tom Mandrake and Klaus Janson. So you've got this gangster in the foreground. It's sort of almost a Justice League image where we're above him looking down at him and he's looking up at us, right?
You want to make something of it?
Right, exactly.
Oh, sorry, I jumped on your joke.
No, it's perfect. You did it for me. So he's got this like sort of orange zoot suit and he's got his black ebony mask on and he's got a gun and he just looks tough like he's going to take us out. And behind him on each side are two coffins. And one, it's got the outfit, the Batman costume with the cape just draping everywhere, almost like blood flowing. It looks almost like the cape. You know, it's got the Robin costume. And then behind him are all these different masks, including a giant symbolic version of his ebony black mask. The font, the logo, pretty weak. It's just a font. But
yeah.
So what do you think of this one? But Tom Mandrake and Klaus Janson.
Other than the logo, as you just mentioned, great image. Yeah. I've always loved this character. I always thought he was really one of the best of the later period Batman villains, in terms of his storyline, you know, his backstory, his look, his whole kind of reason for existing. I really think he is an upper tier Batman villain, and that's saying something. And it's kind of funny that I didn't go back to listen to it because I'm lazy, but I guarantee that when we did the first Black Mask listing for I think it was Who's You Update, I think. He didn't appear in the original series.
Right.
But he appeared in one of the updates.
Did he? I wasn't sure about that, but go ahead.
I'm almost positive that he did. One of them that they finally got around to. That I said, boy, when are they going to put this guy in a movie? Well, now they have now. He was in the Birds of Prey movie. So, I mean, it's like you just wait long enough and eventually everybody's going to show up. I think this is a great image by Tom Mandrake. I mean, I'm a fan of Mandrake and Klaus Janson's a great one of the best thinkers. I just think this tells you kind of everything you need to know about the character. You know, it's like his vengeance. He's sort of calling his shot that he wants to kill Batman or Robin. And I think it's great. Again, I wish the logo had been a real logo. But other than that, I think it's a great piece.
So I'm going to call my shot. Boy, you guys have nailed me home if I'm wrong. He was not in an update. This is his first Who's Who entry ever. Yeah. I'm really, really confident. Again, someone might get me, you know, maybe he was in an appendix or something. But and here's why. Because he appeared in 1985, which, by the way, the first appearance credit on the back, it just says the issue number. It doesn't say the year, so I had to look it up. He appeared in August 1985. He appeared for a couple of issues, and he appeared, you know, it, being the letter B, he appeared after the B issue had come out of Who's Who, right? That's part of the burden of that original Who's Who series is alphabetically, if you come out too late, you know, missed it. So he appears in a couple issues in 1985, and then he's gone. He's just gone. And so when they get around to the updates in 87, it's like, oh, that guy's so 2 years ago where he's not even around anymore. So he didn't even make it in the updates, at least, again, as far as I know. And he didn't really start reappearing in the Batman comics until 1992, right in time for this. So there was a period of time where he just wasn't really an ongoing concern from like 86 to 92, 91, whatever. So and this ties into my story. You were talking about this character. You got so excited, right? I have like no exposure to this character whatsoever. I mean, I must have read a comic or two with him, and I recognize he is massively popular. He's a total blind spot for me. Like when I think of Batman villains, I don't even think of this guy. But I know he's, you know, like you mentioned, the Birds of Prey movie. He's been in cartoons. He's been in the Gotham show. He's been in the Batwoman show. I think he was in the Birds of Prey TV, the original TV series as well. I'm not sure. A million video games. I mean, he is without a doubt one of the like maybe not the top tier, but like right below, you know, the Joker, Riddler kind of level. He's like the next level of bad guy. And I got nothing on this guy.
I can't. I'm looking it up, and I can't find any other Who's Who listings than this one. So maybe this was it. I could have sworn we got to him at something else, but maybe not. Okay. But
to my knowledge, we haven't. So here's the origin, and I'm telling you guys, I know nothing about the guy, so I'm learning it from the Who's Who entry. His name is Ronan Sionis. Sionis. There we go. And he owned Janus Cosmetics. It was this massive cosmetics company. And he was obsessed. He was kind of a weird guy, and he was obsessed with masks. He made several bad decisions with the cosmetics company. Part of that had to do with a woman he was in love with named Cersei. Then Bruce Wayne's company comes in and buys out the cosmetic company. You know, Bruce is thinking he's helping him out, so he buys out the company. Well, this really drove Roman nuts. He went crazy. He creates this mask made of ebony from like the top stone of his dad's grave or something like that. He creates this group called the False Face Society of Gotham. And by the end of that story, he ends up with this mask imprint burned into his face. And he becomes a major Gotham underworld bad guy. Now, again, not really much with him from like 86 to 91, but 1982 from there on, just everywhere, all the time. And nowadays, you know, here it looks like he's genuinely wearing a mask. But nowadays, he looks a lot more like the Red Skull, but like ebony-faced, you know, really. And so at this point, he had just come back and had appeared in Shadow of the Bat and Batman. And that's why he was getting to be a big deal again.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah. I guess not. That's it. Hmm.
Isn't that wild?
It's amazing. Okay. Yeah. Well, there you go. Well, like I said, I still think he's really one of their best villains. I just, this whole look, I think is, I wish they didn't do the skull thing. I think the skull thing is a little more, you know, not as unique. I think this is a better look for him, but you know, okay. It is what it is. But I remember buying those comics off the stands. I was buying Batman at the time and it was, they were just marvelous stories. I remember at the time going, man, this guy's awesome. This guy's so cool. And yeah, I thought it was going to be a big deal and then not really, but now of course he is.
Well, I must have bought those Batman issues and maybe the Shadow of the Bat issues. I'm not sure. So I guess I had some exposure to him, but I just don't remember the guy at all. So, all right. So writer is Doug Mensch. Border is black. Obviously, we already talked about the first appearance. So let's get rolling.
All right.
Up next is, Cerberus. Yeah. Like the three-headed dog from mythology. The image here is, well, first I'll describe the room. It's a being standing in a room, and in the room behind him, lining the walls in sort of a semicircle, are just a bunch of heads in jars. You know, it's like a total, Futurama.
Yeah.
So, and what we're looking at is this giant gray bipedal creature with an enormous chest area. And on the enormous chest is this enormous face. He's got glowing yellow eyes and a glowing yellow mouth. And it's just teeth that go on forever, like a shark. And it's this grayish kind of body. Almost looks kind of like a MODOK or an Armin Zola kind of size of this guy. And he has, again, these heads in jars. He's holding one in each hand. And he's got one like plugged into the top of his body where like a head would normally be. John Bogdanov and Dennis Jahnke did the art. What do you think, Rob?
I've never heard of this character, but man, I love him. I love him. This visual is so insane. This is so crazy. I was shocked to learn this was a Superman character. that they went this crazy, this kind of like H.P. Lovecraft sort of thing in a Superman comic, because this is just I mean, my only thing is like I wish he wasn't colored boring potato sack gray.
Yeah.
I wish he was like red or just something a little more vital. But I love that yellow mouth and the fact that he just sort of plots. I love in the inset panel he's inserting the head into like his little,
right.
I just love it. I think, and then he's breathing fire out of his stomach gut. It's something out of The Thing. You know, John Carpenter's The Thing. And it's funny how little there is to say about him. He's a 1¼ column text.
Yeah.
And that's it. And no other first appearance. That's it. No height, no weight, nothing. But man, I just love this guy. He just looks friggin' nuts.
The design visually is fun. That's about where my enjoyment ends here, folks. I'm glad you're in love with it because I'm not. So the story here is it's another secret organization. This one battled Superman. They had several agents, including the one I love to mention all the time, Sergeant Belcher. Yeah, that was his name, Sergeant Belcher. And this guy appeared, his first appearance was in Superman Man of Steel number 1. Now, that's important because the Superman Man of Steel was the fourth ongoing series, monthly series to be published in the Superman era. So this was the time where it's like we went from having three books to suddenly we had a fourth. So we had a weekly Superman book at this point. So going forward and for many, many years, we'd have a new Superman comic every week. And this was really when the Triangle era was just in its prime. So with that said, I will just pull the Band-Aid off and say that I guess I've already kind of leaned into it, but I love Louise Simonson. And who was writing Man of Steel, and I love John Bogdanov, but man, in my opinion, Superman Man of Steel did not start strong. I mean, Sergeant Belcher and Cerberus is not the way to launch a new Superman book, in my opinion. Other people may feel differently. I'm sure Michael Bailey has already written three paragraphs to tell me why I'm wrong. But the writer of this entry is Roger Stern for the whole, as you said, a column and a quarter. The border is black for villain. It should almost maybe be villain organization based on the way it's written, but At this point, Man of Steel was on issue number 19, and it's November 1992. Do you know what that means, Rob, for Superman?
No, what does that mean?
Well, in Man of Steel number 19, he's fighting this one particular bad guy named Doomsday.
Oh, yeah. Oh, wow.
That's where we are in DC history. In fact, next issue, Doomsday will be in the the Who's Who.
I want Cerberus to be in a Superman movie now. I want to see Superman just beating the paste out of this guy. This guy is just awesome.
That is a petition with one signature. All right, up next is Count Viper. And it's now this is not a 90s looking entry to me at all. This is by Tim Truman. On the right hand side is a man standing there in very traditional. Well, it's not really traditional, probably, but it's stylistic version of what someone might wear during the, you know, era of the Revolutionary War. And he's got long black hair and a ponytail and gloves. And on the left-hand side, there's sort of an interesting border, left-hand panel. And it's at the top, it shows the Declaration of Independence. Then we see Thomas Jefferson. Then we see Ben Franklin. Then we see Teddy Roosevelt. And then we see just a bunch of people. Unfortunately, the logo is just a really bad font. But what do you think of Count Viper's art, Rob?
I mean, Tim Truman's a great artist, but boy, this whole Hawk World thing just never did anything for me. And so these characters are just like, and I looked it up and it said, so first appearance, Hawk World number 30.
Yep.
So I was kind of curious. I looked it up. That book is cover dated January 1993, mm-hmm. which means it was not even out yet.
This is his first appearance right here.
This book came out and yet he has got, look how much info there is on him. They are using every inch of this page for all his backstory. And
Well, I will say, first off, it's written, by the way, the writing here is by John Ostrander, and he wrote the Hawkworld series. Yeah, Hawkworld, by issue 30, for me personally, the shine had come off that book, without a doubt. It does get the creative credit by Timothy Truman and John Ostrander. But I will tell you guys, if you were to sit down and just read this entry, irregardless of the Hawkworld series, it reads really good. I mean, it's really well written. It's engaging. It's fascinating. And I really enjoyed reading this more than I did the Hawkworld comic at the time. So what you've got here is another new character, obviously. He's appearing the same month as our I may have my time. It may be that Hawkworld number 30 was on the shelves like a day or two before this, but I think this came out before him. Anyway, another character with a long legacy. He is older than the United States. He's a Frenchman who was very involved with the U.S. Revolutionary War. He knew all the famous folks, you know, Thomas Jefferson, all those people on the front. He's got these psionic abilities, and he learned he could switch his mind to other bodies. And that's how he's continued to live so long. Every time he starts to die, he just jumps to another body. And he believes that America has gone down a dark path, and it needs to be corrected. And the only way to correct that is that they need a temporary leader to step forward, essentially be a tyrant, and restore our nation to greatness. And once he takes complete control and fixes everything, he thinks he's planning to just return control to the people, which we all know never really works that way. He ends up fighting with Hawkman and Hawkwoman, absolutely. And that's where he sort of fits into this. So the border is black for villain. And I guess we've covered the rest of that. I mean, he's powered all kinds of psionic powers. There's just lots and lots of stuff there. So at this point, you know, Hawkworld, if you wanted, you could, I guess, check out the Being Carter Hall blog. I don't know a lot of other places Hawkman's being celebrated right now. Any more thoughts before we move on from this guy?
Not at all.
Okay. I will say this is the more interesting entry of the Hawkworld entries in the book. So we've got another one coming, folks. All right. Up next is, now this is fun for me. This is Eclipso. And this is, the art is by Bart Sears and Ray Kreising. And oh, in my notes here, there's a note from my daughter that says, hi. She wrote it right in my notes while I was working. Anyway, she asked if I would mention that on the air. So there you go, darling. And so this is the redesign of Eclipso by Bart Sears and Ray Kreising. And yeah, this is, oh, there we go. Thank you. And it's very 90s. I mean, it's very, very 90s. You know,
oh, yeah.
But in a good way. You know, it's Bart Sears. Now, I will say that Bart, as far as I know, oh, shut up. Bart Sears was the only one I know that could draw this version of Eclipso. Nobody else could pull it off like Sears could. But he just looks, he's got this tattered jacket. Everything's got stitching. You can see all the stitching for everything. You know, he's got straps across his bare chest and giant knives, and there's ropes hanging down everywhere. He's got a giant sword. Yes, it screams 90s, but I'm a sucker for Bart Sears. I'm a sucker for Eclipso. I love this visual. And lots of purple, great coloring. Go ahead, poop all over it, Rob. Go for it.
No. It's like the same thing from Abracadabra, that Eclipso originally looked like an elf.
Oh, he looked ridiculous.
You know, he just looked like an elf. And then, of course, times change, and it's like elves are not scary or weird, or, you know, they're so we got to make him look extreme, you know, with he's got the big scimitar, and he's got the chains. And so, you know, I understand that. So, yeah, I mean, look, what's there to complain about? You know, I mean, this is just what they did back then. You know, I think they ramped him up to God of Vengeance as his occupation. It's very funny.
Yes.
I will mention because look, everybody's going to make fun of me for this, but this is the connection. Bart Sears was an instructor at the Joe Kubert School during my years there.
Wait, did you go to the Joe Kubert School?
Thank you. And Ray Christing was literally one of my classmates.
Oh, no way.
Quite literally one of my, yes. Ray was one of my classmates for the first two. He did not stick around for the third year, but he was there for the first 2 years. And Bart Sears had a couple of, I don't want to say proteges, it wasn't that official, but there were some of us that were clearly kind of just a few steps away from ready to do professional level work. And Ray was one of those guys. And I think that's how this happened, is that Bart Sears kind of took a few people with him to do jobs here and there. And I believe that's probably how this happened.
That's cool. Now, 1992, would Ray still have been in at school?
Well, let's see. This is November. Yeah. I mean, well, no. 90. I graduated in May of 92. So
okay.
This came out. So this was after that. So Ray, I was gone by then, and so was he.
Okay. All right. Gotcha. So yeah, you mentioned God. That's really cool, by the way. Thank you for sharing that. That's one of your stories that didn't put me to sleep about work going to school there. So that's great.
It took me 6 months to come up with one.
So yes, he is now officially the God of Vengeance. And so what they did was they took the existing Eclipso origin, and they didn't contradict anything. They just expanded it. So what they said basically is, yes, he is a God of Vengeance, and they added this whole theory of the Heart of Darkness, which is this giant black diamond, which was then chopped up into 1,000 black diamonds. So Eclipso's single black diamond that we always knew he had, turns out that was just 1 of 1,000. And they go on sort of describing a lot of this entry. It's a little more clinical than I would have liked. It describes a lot of the stuff that came out of I am all over the place. I'm trying to finish a sentence here, folks. What I'm trying to say, I'm sorry, is that they just finished the recent Eclipso storyline. They went across all the DC annuals in the summer. It was a major event, Eclipse of the Darkness Within. So they don't actually describe the Eclipse of Darkness Within story in the text. Instead, they sort of describe what came out of it, which is like why there's multiple Eclipsos, how they get manifested, which ones are this version, which one's that version, what the diamond does, all this kind of stuff. So they spent a lot of time talking about that and about how Eclipso, his consciousness was trapped and all this stuff. And so they barely even mentioned Bruce Gordon, which is kind of surprising because, you know, before this change, Bruce Gordon was always tied with Eclipso. You know, this is like alter ego, basically. So here they're focusing on his history and his goals. And like I said, it's a little clinical. I could use a little more maybe flowery language and talk about the anger and the hate that Eclipso feels, because that's kind of what drives the whole character. But anyway, I was all in on this character, man. I absolutely loved Eclipso. I loved the reimagining. The ongoing series, it was a good effort. It unfortunately, you know, when Sears left, it really didn't have the legs underneath it. Oh, by the way, under stats, they add, you know, they got height, weight, eyes, and hair. They added ears. This is pointed. I love that. So they do address his first appearance, House of Secrets, number 61, going all the way back to July, August 1963. This character's been around longer than Doctor Who. And he's obviously a villain. Robert Lauren Fleming wrote the text. I'm pretty sure he wrote the ongoing series and was the driving force behind the Darkness Within, if I remember correctly.
And he's in live action now. He's in the Stargirl TV show.
Exactly right. Yeah, exactly. That's one of the things I was going to mention. You could find him in the Stargirl TV series. If you want to hear some podcasts on him, we did an episode of DC OCD with Paul Hicks. I was the guest on that one, where we talked about Darkness Within. And at this point, on the shelves, again, showing you how fresh this is, the Eclipse of Darkness Within storyline's over, but now Eclipse has got his own book, and they're only on issue number 3 at this point. So,
okay. Are you done with Eclipso?
Yeah, I am. Go ahead.
Okay. Before we move on, do everybody want to hear a funny gossip story from the years of the Joe Kubert School involving Ray Christing?
I will try and stay awake for this one. Go ahead.
This is kind of mean, but yeah, how many times I get to tell the story? So, okay, this would have been my first year at Kubert, and we had a I forget what the assignment was, but anyway, we all brought in our drawings, and mine was some chicken scratch thing that looked like it was drawn by my foot or whatever. And but Ray, as I said, was one of the guys who was kind of near level professional already, and he brought in this drawing of Wolverine.
Okay.
That was really good. I mean, just super, like ready to print in a comic book kind of thing. And, you know, everybody is like really impressed because you're like, oh, my God, you know, my thing is like, I got the, you know, my people look like Picasso with two eyes on the same side of their head and whatever. And here's Ray drawing a Wolverine that looks like it could be a cover. Right. OK. So we go to lunch and we come back. And in that time, another one of the guys in the class, I don't necessarily want to say who it was, although his name rhymes with Krot Krollins, apparently was able to source the image that Ray had lifted the drawing from. And so he took the comic book that this drawing was clearly lifted from and Xeroxed it. And then pasted it on the wall of our classroom.
Oh my gosh.
Next to a sign that said Ray's Amazing Coincidence. and then on top of it was, and this was incredibly industrious of Mr. Krollins, was that he taped it at the very top of the classroom. And these classrooms were about, had about 15 foot high ceilings.
Oh my gosh.
So nobody could reach it, including Ray. Now, Ray, for all of his talents, Ray was on the shorter side. Like, he was a big guy. He had a lot of muscles, but he was kind of like Wolverine, actually. I think he was, you know, I think he was probably like 5'5", 5'6". And Ray lost his mind when he saw that and tried desperately to pull the drawing down, which included putting art tables on top of other art tables and climbing on that art table and
grabbing a
square and trying to pull it down. And it didn't quite work. And, you know, eventually it came down. But that was a big cause celeb at the Kubert School for a while. But, and that person who did it to him was anonymous for the longest time. But I think as legend has gone on, that it turned out to be another relatively famous comic book artist.
Like, so you just outed him. So.
So there you go, everybody.
Now, I thought you guys were always taught that swiping was okay.
Well, yes and no. I mean, the amount of assignments we had to crank out, there was some swiping going on. I did it. Everybody did it. It's just the way it was. The thing is, kind of the unofficial thing is like, you, it's okay to swipe, but don't get caught.
It's like plagiarism.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's like the line from the Traveling Wilburys song, Tweeter and the Monkey Man. In Jersey, everything's legal as long as you don't get caught. It's that kind of thing. It's like, don't swipe so obviously that someone can source it that easily. And he did. And, you know, look, again, no, I'm not knocking Ray. It's 30 years ago, for God's sakes. He was always mean to me, so I don't really care. But but just, you know, oh, he very much was let people know that he perceived their skills to be inferior, and he felt no shame about letting people know that.
Wow.
But, you know, it was just, it was funny that he was the kind of, he was so talented he didn't need to do it. Mm-hmm. It was kind of the thing. It's almost like, geez, why did you even bother? And he probably just because he needed to get it done, you know what I mean, that kind of thing. And it was just the fact that, and you could, it, the reason I'm even telling this story partly is to knock Ray, but no, part of it is that there was a hierarchy there, even within the smallest subset of nerds like us. Mm-hmm. There was a hierarchy where you had people like Krot Krollins and Ray.
Did you keep calling him that?
I just like it. It's very comic book alliteration name. But, I mean, there were people who were more talented than the rest of us, and they lived in their own little strata of Kubertness, while the rest of us were kind of the bottom feeders. And so they picked on each other. And they didn't pick on us as much because it was just kind of that kind of thing. So it was sort of funny to watch one of them take another one of their group down, kind of. So.
You know, it's funny. I just last week when the first episode of Once Upon a Geek, I told a story about nerds, looking for weakness in the herd and going after their own. You know, it's just funny that nerds spend all their lives getting picked on, and yet you put them all together and they start picking on each other too. It's just
the minute you give people some power. Just goes right.
I tell you,
heads.
It does. It does.
Gosh. Sorry for the diversion, everybody. But when else am I going to tell this story?
Right. Well, speaking of giving people power and going to their head, Evil Star
good
is next,
segue.
And the art is by Travis Cherris and Terry Austin. So here's the thing. Here, so it's Evil Star in his traditional costume, purple and blue, and he's got the glowing fist, he's got the red starfish looking mask, and you know, he's got his little starlings around him, the little miniature versions of him, which creep the crap out of me. And the interesting thing here is This is an example of a quote-unquote hot artist. Travis Charest was massive in 92. Hot artist drawing a character and not updating the costume of the 1990s. Because normally, you know, like we saw, abracadabra, it's got to get updated, right? It's got to get updated. And here's an example of what happens when a hot artist doesn't update the costume. So this is sort of the flip. So I'm interested to hear your perspective on this. Before I turn you over, I'm going to say one more thing. I do like how Travis Charest very boldly signed his name in the bottom left-hand corner, right? And he did it so big, right at the bottom of the page, the inker couldn't put their name in there. So Terry Austin had to, like, write his name off to the side. So what do you think of this drawing of Evil Star?
I mean, it's not a bad piece. I wonder where the rest of his legs, I don't know where those are going. Cause like, but I mean, yeah, it's funny. It's a great one-to-one comparison to Eclipso because it's the same approach of like, let's make them now badasses, but Eclipso gets a revised look and Evil Star does not. And even though I was making fun of Eclipso with his, you know, leather biker bar look, Evil Star looks goofy with his big starfish face, you know? So you're kind of like, well, maybe there's something to revamping them or something. I don't know. but yeah. And then, you know, on the insets, you know, the Green Lantern face with like the 4 million lines on his face. It's just like, I didn't know Travis Charest was already a name by this point. I thought he came along a little later.
Well,
I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just surprised that
I might be. I might be getting ahead of my game. Like he came in the first place I ever saw him was on Dark Stars. And while that wasn't a major headlining book, DC did put a lot of push behind it. And he, you know, the first couple issues of Dark Stars were heralded pretty popularly. And then he got scooped out of there and I think took it over to Image, maybe. I can't remember what he did after this. But he obviously did well for himself. I will say it since we're just trashing on people. I wasn't the biggest fan of Travis Charest. Like I recognized that. Or Charest, I don't know how, I'm probably saying his name wrong. But anyway, that I recognized that he was very 90s, but it didn't do much for me. I always felt like he was kind of a Jim Lee clone that didn't quite have the anatomy down like Jim did, is what I always felt like. And I also felt like he had a hard time, like if someone turned their head sideways, it was, well, even everyone here, their face is pretty much straight on. I don't know if you noticed. But whenever someone turned their head sideways, I'm like, that jawline just looks messed up. That head looks flat. Like they just, it just didn't look right. So he didn't do a lot for me. Now, he was supposed to do, I want to say he was supposed to do a Nightwing miniseries, I want to say at one point, if I remember. I might be getting myself mixed up. But, and that might have been great. I don't know. But either way, this doesn't do a lot for me, unfortunately. And I'm sorry to say that.
All right.
So getting on, I will say, I actually went back and looked. I actually prefer the Gil Kane drawing for the original Who's Who of Evil Star. So that says a lot. All right. So a little inconsistency here. We get the first appearance, right? And it gives you issue number 37. Again, no year. Doesn't tell you the year, but it did in other entries, right? So June 1965 is how far back Evil Star goes. He's an alien scientist, and he was striving for immortality, and that corrupted him. And so he then wiped out his own home planet. He ends up battling the Green Lanterns and the Guardians, and he's got his creepy little five starlings. I mean, I'm serious. Those guys freak me out. It really bothers me. Anyway, a lot of this entry, unfortunately, is this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened. And, you know, that happens sometimes, and they got to get all their history in there. So it just gets a little, you know, not my favorite kind of entry. I like more of the spirit rather than, you know, step by step. Anyway, so where this becomes an issue is the Dark Stars, where he does battle the Dark Stars, and that's why Travis Charest is drawing this. In fact, they battled Dark Stars, or I'm sorry, he battled Dark Stars into Dark Stars number 3, which is on the shelf right now. And also at this point, Green Lantern was on issue number 35, just to give you some perspective. A writer of this entry is Robert Greenberger. The border is black for villain. So I don't have a lot more to say about this guy.
Let's move on.
All right. Next up is the Green Lantern Corps. So this is drawn by M.D. Bright and Trevor Scott. So you've got all the Green Lanterns at that time, because the Corps had been falling apart. And at this point in the Green Lantern book, Hal and John were rebuilding the Corps. So a lot of these people are new recruits that they had recruited. I mean, obviously, you're going to recognize Kilowog. You're going to recognize that Crystal Dew with the Mohawk. But that's not Tomar Ray. That's a different bird from his species. And anyways, they were going, and there's Nort in the corner. But they're recruiting the Green Lanterns. So I guess I should read everyone's name here. Let's see. You get of Stone World. You get Emma Nudia of Muscaria. I'm saying that wrong. Boudica of Bellatrix. That's the one that I think most people remember from this era. You get Brick of Dryad, another one that we kind of all remember. Then Chazalon of Barrio 3, Nort of Newt, Hal Jordan of Earth, John Stewart of Earth, Kilowog of Bolivac Vix, Creon of Tebus, Larvox of Spatua. and Tomar 2 of Zundar. All right, so that's the characters involved here. So what do you think of the art, pal?
I like the little mushroom guy. That's making me laugh. Larvox. Yep. Is that his name? Larvox, yeah. It's fine. It's fine. I don't love it. I don't hate it. It's fine. The Green Lantern Corps, I remember when the Green Lantern book became Green Lantern Corps at number 200. They changed it over, and I started losing interest at that point. I don't know. The idea of the Corps is unique to Green Lantern. You know, I know that, like, they tried to, like, the Thor Corps. They tried other characters, and they're like, didn't quite work. But I don't know. I just never took to the Green Lantern Corps as a team. I like the tales of the Green Lantern Corps, like individual stories.
Yeah.
But them together just never did a whole lot for me. So all this stuff is just, I didn't read any of the stuff.
Right. No, I totally understand. So at this point, the Green Lantern Corps series was over, and this was just the Green Lantern book. And the way that series started was, it would be like, I don't know, I don't remember exactly, but maybe 4 to 6 issues. Like, Hal would star for 4 to 6 issues in the story. And then John Stewart would star for like 4 to 6 issues. And then Guy Gardner would star to 4 to 6 issues. And then it would go back to Hal, or maybe Nort would get like 2 issues. And so there was a Green Lantern book, and they would feature on rotating members of the cast. I mean, they never gave like the crystal guy with the mohawk for issues, but it was just like your main Green Lanterns would rotate. And then after a while, they started sort of blending the characters together. And then they did focus on rebuilding the core. The books still stay called Green Lantern, but this entry is about the core. To give you an idea, they're on Green Lantern number 35 at this point, and they don't know it yet, but they're screaming towards Emerald Twilight, which is about 12 issues away, I would say. And behind the scenes, what's going on here is the writer of the Green Lantern book at this point is trying, but he's probably spread way too thin, writing way too many books. He's writing Justice League Europe. He's writing Green Lanterns. He's writing a ton of stuff. And he might even been doing the Ultraverse at this, starting the Ultraverse at this point. I don't know on my timing or not, but to me, the Green Lantern series was just dull. It was boring. And I was actually about to drop it. I did drop the Green Lantern series for like a month right before the whole Reign of Superman and Emerald Twilight thing kicked in. I'm like, oh, wait, something's interesting happening? Let me get back into it. So I actually had dropped the book. I'd gotten so tired of it, but that ended up bringing me back. And this writer was then off the book, and they brought in Ron Mars to make it a lot more interesting. All right, so Border is red for Hero Organization. First appearance goes all the way back to Green Lantern first series, number 11, March 1962. I do like how there's an inset picture of Hal versus Guy. That was a big deal at the time, where they fought it out for who would be the Green Lantern of Earth. I don't think they mention it in the entry, but it's there in the art. So, all right, moving on. Up next is the Heckler. So this is a really interesting sort of snapshot in time, folks. This is a 6-issue character, right? And that's it. And right now, issue number 5 is on the shelves. So this is during – Keith Giffen is the artist, by the way. The artwork here is during his short-lived Trencher period of art style, which is like a zillion lines everywhere, and it's a little much, but I do think this front piece, the composition, is really quite clever and really, really fun. So what you've got is it's like a piece of paper sort of at a skew, and it's got the Heckler on it, but the piece of paper is mostly white, like they haven't finished it yet. It's been you can see the pencils that may not even be inked. It says in the background, there's this big white space, and it says, Bob, make sure the stat gets dropped in here, or we're all going to look like idiots. And then you've got the Heckler in the front, which he's got this really garishly yellow costume, yellow and orange, bodysuit, with this giant smile on his face as part of the mask. He's got a full mask. And the chest part of his thing, where it's orange, is just the word ha written all over everywhere. And the border around the edges also says ha. And I think that this is a really cleverly done piece. I don't know. What do you think of this? As someone who probably knows nothing about this character.
Yeah, I think it's a great piece. Yeah. I mean, the Heckler is almost like if Ambush Bug was too serious for you. this is, you know, Keith Giffen pushing it even further. I mean, you get to the listing on the back and it's all a big joke. Everything's a joke. Alter ego. Hey, that's a secret. Group affiliation. Come on. We can't get into that either. I mean, if you take any of this stuff seriously, the Heckler thing is going to drive you nuts, because you're just like, it's just the insets are just laughter. Just ha ha ha. That's all they are. So, yeah. But yeah, I don't know anything about Heckler at all. But it's like, OK, DC Keith Giffen was obviously had enough pull at DC that he could. I mean, this the text is by Mary Birnbaum, and it's a co-creation of Keith Giffen and the Birnbaum. But, you know, obviously Giffen was a big star. And he had a certain amount of pull at DC, and they, you know, probably let him do some projects they wouldn't normally do. And this is one of those, because it's just completely like, yeah, let's just kind of poop on all the seriousness of this.
He had enough pull to get the series launched, and he also had enough pull to get the series canceled. So interesting story. They actually solicited issue number 7. It was only did 6 issues. They solicited number 7. And once Keith saw the sales figures for the early issues, he actually asked DC to let him end it at 6. And DC let him. They went ahead and did it. So that's the power of what he had here. So I read the series at the time. I loved the idea of it, not necessarily the execution every month, but the idea was really – I like this costume. You didn't say anything necessarily about the costume, but I love this costume design. I wish you could see him just standing, because when you see him standing and not leaping, it's really sharp. The thick black lines, the yellow, the white, the orange, it all contrast, the giant smile on his face. It really looks sharp. So the idea behind it, and I found this online getting ready for this, is Keith Giffen basically said he wanted to create a superhero version of Bugs Bunny. So that's why this is so wacky, so out there, so breaking the fourth wall, all that stuff. That was the point of this. Now, according to the story here, basically what it's saying is, like, according to this, the city of Delta City spoke to this guy named Stuart Mosley, told him to save Delta City. And he owns a diner called Eats Diner. And they explain his big supporting cast he's got. And then the narrative literally starts yelling at the reader, saying that you're not Stuart Mosley, and just starts berating the reader, which again is fun. And his superhero powers are basically got superhuman agility and resilientness and a biting wit. That's basically all the powers he's got. So he leaps around like Spider-Man and just cracks lots of jokes, you know, in a Bugs Bunny kind of way. One of the interesting things that I didn't know back then, but I found in like Wikipedia or some stupid thing, I don't know, that this takes place in Delta City, which is also a location Keith Giffen has used in other books. He used it in that book Vexed. He did, V-E-X-T, which I want to say was maybe an independent book, if I recall correctly. And then he used it in Doom Patrol at different points as well. So it's been around for keeps going back to it. So you've already mentioned the writers on this thing. The border is red for hero, and it says hero in his own mind, which is great. I love that. First appearance is Heckler number 1, and they're on issue 5. It'll be only get one more issue after this. Again, a nice snapshot in time. And shockingly, he just recently reappeared. They did a special recently called a One Star Squadron. So instead of All Star Squadron, it's One Star Squadron, and he's in it. So I haven't read that comic yet, but I'm dying to, because I think there's maybe Firehawks in it, maybe, if I remember right. But anyway, I can't wait to see it.
And you know, as an artist, I appreciate a good stat joke. So
there we go. All right, up next, it may have been where I learned the term stat for all I know. All right, up next is Iceman from the Acronym Legion series. And Rob, how do you know he's from the Acronym Legion series?
What?
How do you know that he's from the Acronym Legion series?
From the logo?
There's a giant Acronym Legion logo right there.
Yeah, exactly. All right. I thought that was like a trick question or something. Like, no, that's from the logo right there. Okay.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, his name's not Legion the Iceman. His name is the Iceman.
Right. Just, yes. You know, yes.
None of the Justice League characters have a Justice League logo on there. So, yes, this is the Iceman. He is a villain of the Acronym Legion. He, on the cover here, he's standing there. It's Barry Kitson artwork. He's standing. He's got his, this is, you're not going to like this if you don't know what you're looking at, Rob. He's got his foot up on a dead dolphin.
Yeah.
He has murdered one of Lobo's beloved space dolphins. So I think the art's perfectly serviceable. I like Barry Kitson. I think sometimes his figures are a little stiff, not quite as dynamic as they could be, but I think the art's great. The interesting costume with the flowing stuff there. Okay, there we go. He is an interstellar hitman, and he's after Lobo. He's all about for the love of the killing, not so much the money. There is very little text here. It's written by Mark Waid. Obviously, Mark didn't have a lot to say about this guy. In reading the entry, I'm still not clear why he's called the Iceman. No idea where that comes from. I don't really have a lot more on this, guys. He's in Legion. His first appearance was a Legion, Acronym Legion, or Legion 91, issue 32, and right now they're in issue 48. So it's been a little while, and you got the inset pictures of him with this mob boss fighting Lobo, and then him turning into energy and flying away.
I'm not a big Lobo fan, but I hope he found this guy and tortured him to death. So,
yeah. So did you know Lobo has a like a colony of space dolphins?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Okay. Yes. Right. Yeah. I figured you would like that about Lobo.
Yeah. I find this image to be, I know it's supposed to, he's a bad guy. I get it. But I just find it to be a grotesque image, and it feels too, just feels very discordant with who's who. Just to have something of a dead dolphin with its blood spilling out. It just feels very like, wow, that's very graphic for what's, you know, kind of like a family-friendly sort of series.
Yep.
You know,
and I don't think I ever took the time to really look at this entry until getting ready for this to realize what I was looking at. I just figured it was he was hanging out with a dolphin, and then I realized what I'm. So I'm like, oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, moving on. Up next is another Legion.
Legion Ignea. Legion. Her name is Legion Ignea, right?
Exactly right. Okay. Well done. Rob's learning. So her Ignea is her name, I-G apostrophe N-E-A. And it's another Barry Kitson. And, you know, it's I will say, a testament to Barry Kitson here, she is a very sexy, very beautiful woman, but it's not over the top. It's not like a 1990s Brokeback kind of ridiculousness. She's, I mean, she's not reserved. She's wearing basically the equivalent of a bathing suit, but sexy without being too much. I don't know. I love the way the cape is splayed out all around her. The dragon is beautiful behind her. I think this is a nice, nice looking piece.
It's funny that you say that because on the insets, the second inset, she's wearing like a Vampirella costume.
Yes.
You see that? Where it's just like just two strands of material over her breast and a little bit over her crotch and that's it. So obviously the front cover is the front piece is her more demure outfit.
Right. So she is a pyrokinetic who has fire powers. She was at this time, she was a new recruit to the Acronym Legion. Vril Dox, who is, of course, the bastard, the jerk leader of Legion, he falls in love with her, as seeing her, any guy would. And he falls in love with her, and they become a couple. And as he's doing all this, Legion begins to fall apart. Turns out she had been manipulating Dox all along on behalf of her father, this gangster called Max God. Or God, or however you say it, she basically caused the Legion to fall apart. So everything gets sorted out, of course, because it's comics, but Doc still harbors feelings for her at this point and has a hard time ever wanting to bring her in. So the entry is written by Mark Waid. It is black border for villain, even though people thought she was a hero at first. And her first appearance was Legion 91, issue number 30. And again, they're on issue 48 right now. So that is that.
She's the Queen of Dragons.
She is. And I don't watch Game of Thrones, so I don't know anything about that. I'm that one guy that doesn't watch Game of Thrones. And now all the comments are just going to be about the fact that I didn't watch Game of Thrones. You're not going to convince me, people. All right. Up next.
I don't think it's going to happen, Chang.
Up next is another Window into Time. I love this. This is never going to appear anywhere else ever. But that's why I love it, right? So it is the Hacker Files. So it is this fun image of this guy who's sitting cross-legged with a keyboard, with a cord.
The cord just it really puts you back in time, doesn't it?
It really does. The keyboard with the spiral cord, like phones used to have, right? And he's sitting there cross-legged. He's got an Anarchy t-shirt on, and he looks grunge before there was grunge here, folks. And he is behind him. Is I don't know whether it's a stat or what it is, but it's this really kind of cool cyberspace sort of imagery. It's green and pink, and it's supposed to represent circuit boards all around him, like he's floating in circuit boards. So it looks very much like cyberspace, I guess, at this point. So what do you think of the image? It's by Tom Sutton, I should say, by the way. Your beloved Omega Men artist, right?
No. He was
no?
No. Tom Sutton did not draw Omega Men.
Oh,
I mean, I didn't read this book. I mean, I got to give DC credit. I mean, they're trying different things between this and the Heckler. I mean, you show they were really, you know, giving books to new concepts and they were trying, you know, I don't think it really worked, I guess. I don't think the Hacker Files really set the world on fire, but, you know, trying different things. So, okay, you know, all credit to them.
All right. I really thought he did a Mega Man. I guess I'm wrong. Okay. So here's the – so his real name is Jack Marshall. And it's Jack Marshall, comma, Hacker, as if he had gone to college and gotten that, you know, that commitment or designation. So I just want to cut to what I really want to talk about, which is Rob and I interviewed Bob Greenberger last time, guys, as you all heard. Well, off the air – Rob and I were just talking with Bob about various stuff. And Rob, you asked him, I don't know if you remember this. You said, hey, Bob, you know, we love chatting with you. We'd love to chat with you anytime. Is there, you know, maybe we should talk about something you never get to talk about. Is there any series you ever worked on that you never get asked about? And he said, without missing a beat, Hacker Files. And we talked a little bit about it. And he said how they had developed it. And he was the editor. So that's why he's not mentioned here. And how it was so ahead of the curve with some of the cyber stuff that they were talking about in there and the hacking and stuff like that. And he was kind of sad that no one's remembers it as being sort of ahead of the curve. So it kind of goes full circle here.
I have no memory of that conversation, man.
Oh, really? Okay.
I'm a really good podcaster.
But it wasn't on the air.
I'm setting things up for later. It's
there we
good.
Go.
Man, for, I'm, really, for I'm your, really good.
Wow. For your 12-issue Hacker Files podcast. Is that what
it's going to be? Exactly.
So at this point, issue number 6 was on the shelves of a 12-issue series. So again, it's very much of the moment, guys. Now, the art, you've got like the little photograph of Jack Marshall, and he's older. His hair's receding. He looks like he's had a bit of a rough life. You know, that one of the inset pictures, he's sitting there arguing with, I don't know, white-haired Henry Kissinger. I don't know who that is. And then his little teenage hackers. One looks like Freddy Krueger there with the sweater. But he is a computer genius, this guy, Jack Marshall, who helped design a computer called the Digitronics computer, which apparently was incredibly successful. It was in every home and every business. In fact, they mentioned it, there's even Digitronics computers in the Pentagon and in the Batcave. So now he's no longer with the company, and he's working outside of Digitronics, and he's discovering something shady within the company, and he's investigating. And he's got this team of supporting teenage hackers who were pictured there. Now, what's not mentioned here is that Oracle, actually, one of Oracle's earliest appearances outside of Suicide Squad is here in Hacker Files. And I covered this comic on an episode of Backworld Oracle with Stella. She invited me on because I was a sucker, and I said, anytime you need somebody to talk about something obscure, give me a call. So she did. And we covered Hacker Files together, the issues that Oracle was in, and they were actually pretty entertaining. So first appearance is Hacker Files number 1. I don't know that they ever appeared anywhere besides the series, but the entry here is written by Lewis Shiner, and the creator credit is to Lewis Shiner and Tom Sutton. The border is red for Hero, and as I said, number 6 is out there at this point, so they're halfway through the series.
I was curious who Lewis Shiner was, because I wasn't familiar with him. I looked him up, and he only has basically a handful of credits. He wrote Time Masters for DC, that miniseries.
Oh, sure.
And He wrote all 12 of this, and he did some other stuff for some other companies. And then I looked at the covers for the Hacker Files, and it's funny, if you look at this, you look at the covers of that book, it looks like a Vertigo book. The covers are very abstract and painterly, and yet it's not. It's not a Vertigo book. It's just a DC book. And in fact, you see on a couple covers, Green Lantern is there. Yes, so they must have some sort of crossover, but I had no memory of this book at all. But I mean, it's funny how it like was seemingly kind of misbranded, because it does not look like a DC book. It looks like, despite Green Lantern being in it, it looks like something you would see on a Vertigo label.
Yeah. And now this is pre-Vertigo. So, you know.
There you go. Okay.
If it had been a year or two, and which we're going to get to right next, because we've got a sort of proto-Vertigo character in the next entry. So, interesting. All right. So next entry is Lady Jane from the Swamp Thing book. Again, this is right before it goes to Vertigo. Art is by Scott Eaton and Kim DeMolder. Now, here is a very, what I would say, anti-90s entry. She is this beautiful plant elemental woman. So her hair is like green, weeping willow kind of style. Her skin is kind of like a maybe branch color. And she's wearing an outfit. The cloth is sort of tattered. You can see like things growing on it, and you know, her feet, she's barefooted and everything. So she's very beautiful, but you can tell she's a plant animal. And, you know, honestly, if it wasn't colored, you might not know she's a plant elemental, now that I think about it. But what do you think of this very non-90s cover or, you know, artwork?
That's pretty. The logo is just a typeface, which is very hard to read.
Yeah, bad color.
That's an unfortunate choice. But it's a very pretty image. I'm not familiar with Scott Eaton. I'm very familiar with Kim DeMolder, partly from his credits. And again, I hate to keep bringing it back, but he was my instructor a couple different years at the Kubert School.
Oh, geez. Wow. Okay. I had no idea.
Love the guy. Love. Great guy. Great guy.
I think the art is very, very pretty here. It's a contrast to the rest of the book. Because the rest of the book, there's got a lot of dynamism going on here. This one, not so much. And that's okay, because that's the style of the Swamp Thing book. But I don't know. It's kind of, you don't remember it. You know, you don't remember this entry. That's kind of the sad thing, I guess. So the story here is that Lady Jade was a previous Earth Elemental. The entry, by the way, is written by Mark Waid, and it is moving. I would recommend anyone go out and read this. It's very moving. She's a previous Earth Elemental from the 1800s. There's this tragic, tragic tale in here outlaid about the mistreatment she suffered at the hands of men, about her children dying in a fire, and then about her becoming the Earth Elemental. I mean, it's really very sad. And now she is, you know, alive again. She went off to the Parliament of Trees, just like every Earth Elemental does. And now she is brought back, and she's the nanny to Tefe, which is the daughter of Swamp Thing and Abigail Arcane. Now, she first appeared in Swamp Thing 119, which is just about 8 months ago. And Nancy Collins was the writer, so she wrote those issues. And this is right before Vertigo. And I was reading the Nancy Collins stuff. I don't have any recollection of this character at all. There's nothing. Now, it could be that maybe I came in after, maybe she didn't hang around, because I don't remember Tefe really being around all that much. So I have no recollection of this character whatsoever. And I did read a lot of the Nancy Collins stuff. That was my Swamp Thing era.
Yeah, I was off Swamp Thing by this point. So.
Yep. And then, you know, if you want more of Swamp Thing, there was a TV show to watch. I mean, again, everything's now Lady Jane wasn't in there, but everything, you know, everything is out there in big. So, all right. Did I mention the Boers Blue supporting cast? I think this is the first supporting cast member we've had in the century. So, all right. Up next is our cover characters. It is the Legionnaires. So these are the teenage Legionnaires. I'm going to explain the details behind that because it's a little confusing. But these are the teenage Legionnaires in all redesigned costumes, redesigned names. It is your traditional Legion that you might know, like the classic maybe Silver Age version, but done for the modern era. And they're leaping out at you. You've got speed lines there. You've got the Legion logo. If I have any criticism of this, it's that they're not quite big enough. It's like,
yes, that's the only thing I was going to say. It's why are they so small on the page?
Yeah, it's to get the speed line effect, they kind of pushed them to the left a little bit, where they could have just grabbed a, you know, like Photoshop and enlarge scale, right? And made that a little bigger.
Yep. So, it's a great image, though. It's a great drawing. It's exciting. It's vibrant. It looks cool. It's just a little too small.
So as a Legion, you know, lifelong lover, Rob, that you are. And I hope everyone knows that's a joke. What do you think of this art style and these looks for these characters? Like, you know, there's Sunboy, right? Well, he's not what he's called, but like, look at Sunboy's costume design. What do you think?
I think this looks great. I compared to the drab, you know, L.ED.EG. whatever that crap is. This looks bright and cheery, and to me, this is what I imagine when I think of the Legion of Superheroes. Is this kind of bright, forward-thinking kind of thing. Again, I never read any of these, but this looks terrific.
Awesome. I'm glad you like it. And this really bizarre, the costume design element they introduced here that kind of goes through almost all the characters is that, I don't even know how to describe this, but they have like, I lack the words here. Maybe you can help me. It's the vertical design that goes down the middle, like the chest down to the legs. Right. So like the legs are split down the middle, like the right hand edges of the legs. How do I describe this, Rob?
Center stripe.
There we go.
Going from their neck down to their feet. And then you've got the matching colors on the outside. Yeah. So it's a motif across all their uniforms with different variations.
Exactly. Thank you. That's what I was trying to verbalize and I couldn't. So, and that was a nice way to bring the team look together. So, all right. So the interesting thing about this is Legionnaires, it doesn't say Legion of Superheroes. It says Legionnaires. And that's very purposeful because 3 months from this point, there's going to be a second Legion book on the shelves. There's a Legion of Superheroes book on the shelves. And now there's going to be a Legionnaires book on the shelves and it will feature these characters. So here's kind of the interesting thing. So remember, you know, the dark drab 5 years later stuff that we talked about, right? So during the dark, dreary 5 years later era, suddenly and unexpectedly appears these teenage versions of the Legion, right? But they didn't replace them. They're side by side. There's the dark, dreary ones and the colorful teenagers together at the same time. Like there's two Element Lads. There's two Shrinking Violets. There's two of all these people. And it introduces this huge mystery. Are these kids clones of the original characters? You know, are they the Legion time displaced from the past now stuck here? Or are these the original Legion and they were stuck in like cryo chambers and the adult Legion are the clones? We didn't know. Unfortunately, we never really get a good payoff on it because 0 hour happens and they just have to hurry up and close the whole shop up is what happens, which is a little fortunate. But so what's going on at this point is on the shelves this same month. So these guys were introduced in Legion of Superheroes number 24. So they've been kicking around for about 14 months as sort of supporting characters in the Legion of Superheroes book. And because right now they're on the shelves this month is Legion of Superheroes 38 and 39. And that's important because in issue 38, sorry to say, spoilers, everybody, Earth was destroyed. So pack your shit up now, folks. It's going to be gone by Legion of Superheroes 38 in the 29th or 30th century or whatever. So, yes, Earth is destroyed. And it also featured a very, very rare appearance of Neil Gaiman's death outside of the Sandman comic.
Whoa.
Yeah, I didn't know
that. Wow.
Now, I can't remember if that's the one Neil Gaiman got mad about or it was the Captain Atom one. I can't remember. So one of them he got ticked off about. I know, right?
Why would he get mad about one of his greatest creations showing up in Captain Atom?
Maybe that's the one he got mad about.
Dear Lord.
Anyway, what happens is Earth is destroyed and a lot of the cities like form a bubble around it and blast off into space before it's destroyed. So a lot of cities survived, and they've kind of connected up in space, kind of like a, almost like a space station, all these floating cities connected. And so these legionnaires, their mission now is going to be to protect New Earth out in space. And Chameleon Boy, or here he's called Chameleon, is now the adult member of the team. He's from the Drab 5 year later group. He's the adult one, and he's sort of overseeing all these teens. Now, one thing I wanted to point out here is all the new code names, you know, all the lad, Lad and Lass, that was all through, those are all gone with the exception of Matter Eater Lad. You know, Pharaoh Lad is now Pharaoh. Triplicate Girl is now Triad. Lightning Lad is now Livewire.
Cosmic Boy is still Cosmic Boy.
Yep, Saturn Girl still Saturn Girl. You've got Kid Quantum, who's a new character. Andromeda is Laurel Gand, who is the post-crisis equivalent of Supergirl. They got Matter Eater Lad. Then instead of Colossal Boy, you've got Leviathan. You got Catspaw, which is a new character. Instead of Sun Boy, you've got Inferno. Brainiac 5, still Brainiac 5. Instead of Phantom Girl, it's Apparition. Shrinking Violet kept her name. Ultra Boy kept his name. Instead of Element Lad, it's Alchemist. Computo is a new character. She kept her name. Invisible Kid. Okay, so I guess you still have one kid. Same name. Instead of Light Lass, we have Gossamer. And the Dragon Mage is also a new character. So I wanted to ask, so we've talked about the costumes. We like those. What do you think of the new names?
I get it. Like putting Kid and Lass, it feels very dated. So I don't hate this. I'm glad that the names are not extreme names. Like, you know, right. They're more gentle. Leviathan, Livewire. Like, okay, that's fine. They're not, it's not like, Shrapnel, you know, or anything like that. So, if you're trying to update it a little, that's not too bad.
Not one blood anywhere in the
day. Yeah, right, exactly. Blood or Talon or that kind of, Claw. They're more gentle names, which to me is befitting the whole tone of this series.
And so, again, these guys don't last too terribly long because, again, the Zero-Hour reboot. I think ultimately, in the hurry to wrap it up, they end up saying that they're time-displaced versions of the Legion, so both versions were real. I can't remember. But you do essentially get this team in the post-Zero-Hour relaunch. So Zero-Hour relaunches, they reboot the Legion entirely, and this really does sort of form the core of where they – now, it's not exactly one-for-one, but it's pretty darn close. And so these are kind of the core ideas that go forward with the Legion in that post-crisis era, and it's a great, great run of Legion post-crisis. And I think Cisco will back me up on that. So, all right, so Red Border for Hero Team. I mentioned first appearance again, Legion Super Heroes 24. Now, they were called the SW6 batch for a long time until they started calling Legionnaires. And the writer on this entry is Tom and Mary Beerbaum, so you know it's written within an inch of its life. Now, for Legion character, oh, by the way, we never said Chris Sprouse and Carl Story were the artists on this. I should have mentioned that.
I love the insets, too, of them all standing together. It looks great.
Yeah. And Chris Sprouse becomes kind of like the house style for the Legion for quite a while. These kid versions. So really, even the artists that come after him, it's like he is the template for it. So for Legionnaires, of course, you can just turn to your TV. You can watch them on Smallville. You can watch them on Supergirl. You can do cartoons. And apparently there's a new Legion of Superheroes TV series in development. So
my God.
Yep. All right. So coming up next is, all right. Oh, okay. So here we go. I'm so excited about this.
All right. Oh my God.
No. All right, get your phone. Get ready. All right, you ready? So, all right, this is Lord Satanus. All right, Lord Satanus. And he's this demon-looking guy, red and purple, with white flowing cape and horns and everything. And he is walking towards us. His foot his right foot is stepping forward. And, like, there's all those explosions coming out where his foot is. He's got his hand outstretched. And, big logo, Lord Satanus. So, first, what do you think of the art?
It's not bad. When I looked at the inset on the back, I'm like, God, the 90s Superman comics got weird.
Yeah, that's fair.
Just got really weird.
So, do you notice anything on the front image under Mr. Breeding's signature?
Yeah, I can't read it. It says Breeding after something something. I am looking at scans and I can't make it out.
I got my real pages out. It says Breeding after Walt Simonson and Tom Palmer. So I'm thinking, okay, after Walt Simonson, and this is the thing, as I was telling you about before we started recording, Rob. I sat there and just sat for a long time after Walt Simonson and Tom Palmer. So what obviously, something has inspired Brett Breeding to draw this pose of the Walt Simonson and Tom Palmer did. So what do you think it might be?
I mean, Walt Simonson makes me think Thor, but Tom Palmer never worked on Thor.
So that was my first instinct as well.
I don't know. I don't know. What is this referring to?
Check your phone.
Oh, Jesus. This is like the Saw series or something. I don't see anything on my phone, sir.
It's not Facebook. I texted it to you. Maybe it's going to take a second to be delivered.
Okay. Okay.
We'll give it a second to get delivered here. But folks, this image, I sat there and I was bringing, you know, it's like, oh, maybe it's a Thor thing. Maybe it's whatever. And then it came to me. One of my favorite comic book pages of all time. It is not a cover.
Oh, there it is.
Yeah. It is from Star Wars, Marvel freaking Star Wars, issue number 62, one of my favorite Marvel comics of all time. And this has to do with the saga. I don't know if you're sure. I know you love Marvel Star Wars. I don't know if you kept reading it all the time.
I did. I read the whole series.
Okay. So this is during the Shiera Bree storyline. So Shiera Bree has died. Luke goes to her home planet to find her. And he like finds this, activates this thing, and suddenly Darth Vader appears right in front of him, and he says, "Luke Skywalker, I have come for you." And it's this huge dramatic pose. I mean, like, I couldn't wait 30 days for the next issue. I was losing my mind, because back then, you know, Darth and Luke weren't supposed to meet, because this is after Empire and Return. They weren't allowed to meet. In fact, the writers were not allowed to meet them, and it turned out to be a trick. It was a hologram. That's how they got around it. But we knew that Luke and Vader were not allowed to meet in the Marvel comics, so this was so freaking crazy. So I was, again, sitting there today looking at this drawing, and I thought, well, when I think of Simonson and Palmer, I think of Star Wars. And then, boom, it hit me. It is that freaking page. I'll put this in the gallery.
Wow.
So you'll see the Lord Satanist. And you'll see, and again, it's not even a cover. It's the last page of that issue. You'll see the Darth Vader image, and folks, you're going to love it. Oh, it's good, so
detective
good
work, Shag. Well done.
Thank you.
I wonder what inspired Breeding to do, like, what, you know, this is 1992, and he's referring to a Star Wars comic from, like, what, say 8 years earlier?
Probably 82. Yeah.
Yeah.
All I can think is, again, this image, this page of Star Wars is burned into my mind as a kid. I mean, I thought about this page all the time. It's one of my favorites. And so that's all I can think is maybe that's what inspired him. I don't know. That's the best part of this discussion, because now we got to talk about Lord Satanus.
Well, we don't really.
Well, here's the thing. This goes back to your earlier discussion about why didn't Black Condor get mentioned, right? Why didn't he get credit, the previous incarnation? And this is the thing that bugs the crap out of me. Now, Michael Bailey, please, this is where you have your TED Talk. This is your moment. This is what everything's been leading to, Mike. This is your time. Because this ignores entirely the previous version of Lord Satanus. And it bugs the crap out of me. Because there is a pre-crisis Lord Satanus. However, it is spelled one letter different. So where this Satanus is ends, you know, the U.S., the pre-crisis one ends in an IS.
Oh, that's right. I remember that guy.
There's a Who's Who entry for him.
Kurt Swan did the last thing. Of course he
exactly
did. Superman, yeah.
And they look pretty similar. Now, their histories are pretty different. Okay. You know, the other one was like from the future or some such one. And it kind of pisses me off because, like, why on earth is this considered an all-new character? Because everywhere you look, like, there's creator credits for this Lord Satanus. I'm like, no, he's just the other guy. He looks the same. The name is spelled one letter different. I mean, how is that deserving of a full, you know, new character? It just drives me nuts. So, Michael Bailey, please enlighten me. So, all right.
Just as a side note, I'm very charmed at the idea that you think you need to invite Michael Bailey to comment on something. That's very funny. He's normally so demure with his comments. You got to ask for them.
That's true. Okay. So this version of Lord Satanus.
Love you, MB.
He has an evil sister named Blaze, who is the ruler of hell. And he originally ruled hell, but was deposed by his sister. Now, Blaze had been around in the Superman comics for a little while. So now this guy gets introduced, and he's on Earth. He's disguised as the publisher of Newstime magazine, a guy named Colin Thornton, who was a supporting character in Superman for quite a while. Now, in order to stop Blaze, Lord Satanus does team up with Superman. But just keep in mind, just because he worked with Superman, it doesn't matter. This guy's still evil, and he'll be a foe of Superman for quite a bit. And again, it's just so weird to me the way they treat him separately. They do get your Thornton first appearance of Superman 38, and then you get Satanus' first appearance, Adventures of Superman 493. And these things are, you know, several years apart, like in 1989 and 1992. So it's a long, long time in between. Now, at this point, Adventures of Superman 498 is on the shelf, so it had been 5 months since Satanus had appeared. The border here is black, but I would argue, why not Supernatural? You know?
That's why they should have never done that.
Yeah,
because it makes no sense. Yep. It makes no sense to break that up. I like him without his helmet because he looks like Tim Curry from Legend.
He does. He really does. The horn's a little thinner, not quite as the girth of it, but it still looks very similar.
A little Superman.
The writer is Roger Stern, but you know, like it's sort of like what you joked about earlier with the Cerberus. It's like Roger just couldn't be bothered to write much text. He's just like half a – he's like one column, and there's just miles of empty space.
Guys, I got a lunch date. All right, here, just fine. There.
Yep.
All right.
Exactly. So if you want more on this character, of course, you can check out the From Crisis to Crisis podcast. This guy's probably been in a movie or some shit. I don't care. All right. up next is Mr. Z. So this is a character drawn by Jerry Ordway. And it is just an elderly man in a tuxedo, like the sides of his head are shaved. He's got this big bushy mustache. He's holding a cane or a scepter. And it's got a giant gemstone on the end with energy pouring out of it. And he's just very casual. I mean, his arm is graced over the back of the chair. His legs are crossed. And behind him are these photos or images. One is of Hitler and him. One of him and Abraham Lincoln. One of him and like a Shakespearean sort of thing. Hit one with him and Nixon. So once again, we have another character who's hundreds or thousands of years old in this issue. It keeps repeating. So what do you think of this image?
It's Jerry Ordway. So, you know, it's great. Yep. The Superman books got goofy.
They were good, though.
Again, I'm not knocking them. It's like they featured these characters, and I'm like, I just can't wrap my head around that these were in Superman comics. But, man, the artwork is just unreal. Fantastic. So much life to it. I love the inset of him twirling his little mustache, and then him with Superman with no cape on for some reason.
So, all right.
It's super funny. Cool. Him breaking through the wall. They look awesome. They're really cool.
It was kind of an interesting character, the way they did this. So Superman and Mr. Z met each other out of sequence because of some wacky time travel shenanigans. So, like, Superman battles Mr. Z in modern day, and Mr. Z is like says, we fought before. And Superman's like, no, we haven't. I don't know what you're talking about. Then Superman gets thrown back in time to World War II, and then he fights Mr. Z. So it's Superman's second time and Mr. Z's first time. So it was really kind of clever the way they did that. So anyway, they fought in the 40s when he was a Nazi, then in Metropolis. This gemstone that's at the top of his little cane, his little staff or whatever, actually steals souls. And that's where he gets a lot of his powers from. Eventually, Superman and Mr. Z get stranded on a Pacific island, both with amnesia, which is what's happening. That
coconuts. Okay.
Yeah. He's like, Superman's knocking a coconut out of the tree and it's bonking Mr. Z on the head. It's hilarious. I mean, it's good. It looks like a Laurel and Hardy kind of moment or something. Right. So, it'd been about 2 years since this character first premiered. He unfortunately didn't really stick around. I don't know if he ever even appeared after this at all. I'm not really sure. But first appearance of Superman number 51. Right now they're on issue number 75 of Superman. Once again, the death of Superman. The writer here is Roger Stern. Border is black for villain. So, all right, we'll move on, but that's a fun one. All right, up next. Oh, goodness gracious. Okay. So we talked about Hawkworld before. This is the less interesting Hawkworld entry. So it is the Netherworld. So the art here is by Tim Truman, and we've got all these crazy-looking people. You've got two cat-like feral people. They're like furries in the front. You've got a lady whose top half is like a girl with a samurai sword or a scimitar, and her bottom half is literally a motorcycle. Like she's like a centaur, but it's a motorcycle. Her name is Mustang Sally, by the way. Then you've got, I'm pretty sure that's Slash from Guns N' Roses. And you've got a bunch of other punks.
This guy looks like Jerry Garcia.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. He does. I didn't think about that. Yeah. So, Rob, what do you think of this one?
Don't throw this onto me. Don't.
Okay.
You dare. Now, I like Tim Truman, but that character in the front is simultaneously giving us a profile shot while seeing her entire ass, which is physically impossible. So, okay, that's fine. Again, the fact that these characters first appeared in Hawkworld number 30, a book we already just talked about, and their history is filling the page. This whole Hawkworld thing. No.
But hats off for John Ostrander to develop this much backstory though. Like you didn't get all of this in the comic, you know, I mean, he was really fleshing it out. So, I mean, that's fantastic. If he had been doing a book that didn't have Hawkman in it, it might be highly regarded. You know, as being like this really cool.
Yeah,
and edgy.
Okay, that's fair. I think yes. I think what I don't like is that it's all of this stuff has been grafted onto two beloved characters.
Yeah.
So yep. Yeah, that's fair.
Yep. So again, Count Viper, same, like you just said, same first, both on the stands this month and getting us. Interesting, this is a geography post, not a character, not a villain, not a group, anything. It's geography. Because Netherworld is actually an area of Chicago where metahumans live, who are traditionally shunned. Like they have shunned the life of being, they don't want to be a traditional superhero. They don't want to be a traditional supervillain. But if they got powers, though, so where do they go? So they have created their own little place in Chicago called Netherworld. I'm pretty sure that's where Max Romero lives,
actually. Yeah, I was wondering, has he ever been there? I was curious.
Yep. So there's a club that everyone goes to called Slaughterhouse. And the type of characters break down into like three major different types. There's the freaks, spelled with PH, which are characters with powers. Then there's the hairballs, which are like the werebeasts. Mm-hmm. And then you've got the nasties. Who, this is sort of interesting. These people all have like crazy tattoos, but the tattoos are symbiotic creatures that live on them. And when they die, the tattoo moves to the next person, a little bit like Venom. So it's kind of cool there. I count Viper's manipulating all of them. And that's about all I've got to say on this. So, what else? It's sort of interesting. We have a group chat where we talk about business and make fun of Max Romero, for Fire and Water Network. And I, you know, was talking about prepping for Who's Who, and I'm like, yeah, what are you guys doing tonight? Because I'm prepping for a character no one remembers called Netherworld. And Siskoid immediately pops up and goes, oh, really? Listen to the latest episode of 0 Hour Strikes, because they're in it. So we'll just call them, these are the stars of the 0 Hour Strikes podcast, folks. Right,
they are now the Jennifer Schwartz Levine of Hawkwork characters.
That's right.
Twice in 1 week.
On the network, that's right. All right, up next is Starbreaker. Now, this is a classic Justice League villain. Again, no costume updates here, but it's Dan Jurgens drawing, and his Rick Burchett is the inker, drawing the character in a modern way using the original costume. He's done sort of a creepy thing where the head is sort of leaned forward, so almost all of his face is in shadows except for his eyes and his forehead and hair. So like his nose, his mouth, his cheeks, all that's in dark, dark shadows. And Starbreaker is famously known as the Cosmic Vampire. So behind Starbreaker, it looks like almost like a giant explosion of energy. So what do you think of this artwork here?
Oh, it's great. I remember this character from Justice League. I have the issue that he first appeared in. The logo, unfortunately, is just a typeface. But no, it's cool. On the inset, we get our only appearance of Aquaman in a tiny little shot way in the back as Starbreaker's busting the JLA up. But yeah, it's cool. And I'm glad that he was not, they didn't, you know, extreme him up. You know, he looks like he does in his first appearance.
Yep, and so it's Dan Jurgens. What he did was, in fact, I interviewed Dan for the Justice League International podcast recently. And we were talking about his run on Justice League that he did after the Bwahaha era, and he specifically said he really wanted to use Starbreaker because he loves the phrase Cosmic Vampire. And so he used Starbreaker, and that's why you see the inset picture of him battling Booster Gold. So the gist of Starbreaker is that he consumes life energy, and he'll go to a planet, consume the life energy of the people, and then literally throws the planet into the sun and feeds off of that energy as well. I mean, talk about salting the earth behind you. It's pretty vicious. So in the stories here, it talks about how he attacked Ron, so the Justice League got involved with him. And then in the more recent story, he attacks Almorak, which was the homeworld of Maxima, who was part of that Dan Jurgens Justice League at that point. So they end up fighting him. Obviously, the Justice League wins and defeats him. And first appearance is Justice League of America number 96, going all the way back to February 1972. The border is black for villain. It's written here by Mark Waid. And again, we talked about Dan Jurgens is on the art. Now, Justice League itself was on issue number 70. So it had been a few months since we've seen Starbreaker. But they're also dealing with the death of Superman at this point. All right, up next. Now, this is very extreme. Not going to deny it. But, dude, I love this. Like, I legitimately love this. So there's a window, a very small window of Legion time period here where somebody, I guess it was it Al Gordon? Yeah, I think Al Gordon maybe was the motivator behind this possibly, decided to let's take one of the more popular Legionnaires, Timberwolf, and try and spotlight him. So they gave Timberwolf his own miniseries, and they shot him back to the 20th century to have adventures here. So that's a way to break away from the Legion. I mean, they did it before with Karate Kid, right, in the 70s. And they completely revamped him as a were creature. So here he's got almost a traditional Legion costume from, like, the nipples down. It's got that, like you said, that white center section, right? With some sort of slashes in there to look cool. And then red on the outside. And then his top half, right above, basically above the sternum or whatever, he's all bare chested. got tons of animalistic hair everywhere. He's gone very feral. He's got giant like wolf ears. He's got the fangs and hair and a giant flowing mane with white temples and super crazy long claws. And it is very 90s, okay? It is Joe Phillips doing the artwork here. You say what you will. I love this. So what do you got?
I mean, the artwork's nice. Great movement. You really feel like there's a lot of things going on. It makes sense to me that they would kind of look for a character that could, you know, be a little bit of that Wolverine type heat.
Exactly.
And Timberwolf, there's his name. Yeah, I'm glad they didn't change his name. They didn't need to. I'm glad they kept Timberwolf. It wasn't like they were like, you know, Claw, you know, whatever. They just kept it Timberwolf. That said, I think it looks a little silly. Like to me, the costume combined with the feral part doesn't match.
Yeah,
I wish they either just give him like trunks and just that, or but artwork wise, it's terrific. Like I said, it looks really good.
Joe Phillips is a great artist, so I mean, I really like this. Now, the series itself, I haven't read it since it first came out. I love the inset picture. It's him, like it's like the Hank McCoy Beast stuff. You know, he's obviously a monster, but he's got his little glasses on. He's wearing a suit and tie. You know, his hair is pulled back in a ponytail. He's looking very, you know, prestigious. I don't remember the series necessarily being that great, the miniseries, unfortunately, because I really wanted it to be. So the story was, you know, during that 5 year later era of Legion, you know, he was actually transformed into this giant, like almost, I can't remember what the character was from the Looney Tunes. He was a giant character, was just a big furball. This guy was furball. He was
The big monster, the big orange monster. Okay.
Yeah, so basically what Timberwolf was during the 5YL. And then his friend Arya transforms him. And she gets all these powers. She becomes Gemini. She magically heals him, but at the same time, actually transports him back to the 20th century and transforms him into this sort of feral personality. So again, it was a chance to try and give the character something to do. Now, I got to say, like, the first paragraph here is hilarious. I'll just read it real quick. It says, Bryn Londo, who, by the way, has gone by the names of Bryn Londo, Timberwolf, Lone Wolf, and Furball. He's had a lot of names, right? Bryn Londo has gone through more physical and personality permutations than a schizophrenic Derlin. While some may call this an identity crisis, others would say it's all part of growing up in the 30th century. That just cracked me up. I love that they've got their tongue firmly planted in the cheek with that. Al Gordon did the writing here and the inking. So it's fun. Again, I love the concept. I don't believe, and I should go back and reread it. I don't think the execution quite worked as well. So his first appearance was Adventure Comics number 372, all the way back in December 1964. Keep in mind, Timberwolf predates Wolverine, folks. And there's a lot of arguments around the 70s about who was the cool, you know, wolfy kind of hunty tracking kind of guy. Who was stealing from who? So there's a fair question there. Especially
Timberwolf predates him by what?
Yeah, but he wasn't quite as Wolverine-esque at that point. It took a while for him to develop into it.
Yeah.
And then you get, you know, Dave Cochran, right, jumping between X-Men and Legion. So it's, you know, which came first, the chicken or the egg? And I know all the Legion fans can answer that question. I can't. But so at this point, the Timberwolf miniseries was only on issue number 2. So most of this history here is more about the character than what happens in the miniseries. And the border's red for Hero. And if you want more on him, of course, you can check out the Legion of Super Bloggers, or you could watch him in probably some Legion cartoons or TV series or whatever, I'm sure. All right. Up next is Valor. So this is drawn by M.D. Bright and Al Gordon. And what this is basically taking the Mon-El costume, right, of Mon-El, and giving it a 90s touch, you know, making it go sleeveless and giving him giant shoulder pads and giving him, you know, fingerless gloves, you know, it's very, you know, giving him some pouches. So it's very much taking the traditional Mon-El costume and making it, reimagining it for the 90s, because at this point, Mon-El was living in the 1990s, in the 20th century. And I'll talk about the whys in a minute, but here he's flying through space and there's like a spaceship flying behind him. What do you think of this piece, buddy?
I mean, it's fine. I'm not really familiar with this iteration of Mon-El. I knew that he became Valor at some point. Artwork is nice. I really love that little ship. It looks like something out of Micronauts. I think it's a really beautifully drawn little spaceship. You know, sometimes the simplest things are the best. The inset picture is upsetting because it looks like the top of his head has been shorn off. He's got kind of a Frankenstein head shape. Which is weird, but other than that, you know, it's like, it's fine. It's why do they change his name to Valor? Like, what was wrong with Mon? Is because it was Kryptonian?
That's part of it.
Can't have that anymore, because obviously you can't have any more Krypton survivors.
That's part of it. Now, real quick, I just do want to address the art. You know, this is not the first time we've pointed out M.D. Bright is often quite serviceable, but the man's got a problem with heads. Like I can't
love
like,
square heads. He really put him on a Frankenstein book. It'd be perfect.
We talked about a character. I don't remember who it was in the last issue that he drew too. We were both like, what's going on with the head there? Looks like Hector Hammond. So yeah. All right. So I will say about the cover image. Again, problem with the head, but I like the costume. It does scream 90s though, but I will say MD Bright really used the full page to effect. Like you've got all the star field behind him. You've got this giant planet. I mean, just takes up the whole like quarter top right-hand quadrant. I think that looks great the way he did that. So I think it's a clever usage of it. So, all right. The whole thing is, if you know your original Mon-El history, you know, he actually comes from the 20th century. You know, in the old Superboy comics, he and Superboy hung out in the Silver Age, literally, and then he got sick, so they stuck him in a pocket dimension, and he was there for 1,000 years and came out and joined the Legion. So Mon-El had a history in the 20th century, so that's what they're keying in on here. They're saying, okay, let's play with that. Let's play with that in the post-crisis world. So what they're saying is Mon-El, Superboy's gone now, right, post-crisis, so what are they going to do? He kind of functions like a Superboy in the DC Universe at this point, and he is having these adventures in the 20th century, and instead of Superboy inspiring the Legion in the 30th century, Mon-El's adventures in the 20th century are what's going to inspire the Legion in the 30th century. So he's going around having these larger-than-life adventures. In one tale, they tell us that he had this giant adventure where he battled the Dominators, and they had all these humans there, people they experimented on and gave all these people powers. Well, he took all these metahumans with powers and dropped them off on different planets around the cosmos. And over 1,000 years, those people basically became the planets that formed the Legion, like, you know, where Cosmic Boy was from, or Saturn Girl was from, or Lightning Lights. Like, he seeded all those planets.
Bismol? So he seeded Bismol?
Maybe. I don't know exactly. But so that's sort of his legend. So, they give him the name Valor to try and get away from Mon-El. Exactly right, to get away from the Superman legacy. They call him Valor. And at this point, this is sort of spinning out of Invasion. It's also sort of spinning out of the Eclipso series, where they give Valor his own series. Right now, he's only on issue number 3. So he's still early in his adventures. The book didn't quite live up to the expectations. He wasn't quite as amazing as we all hoped. And I think that's probably more down to the writing than anything else. But it's a clever way to use a pre-existing part of his story where he lived in the 20th century and really flesh it out in a new post-crisis kind of way. I think it's pretty cool. So, of course, the history stays the same, though, where, you know, he ends up trapped in another dimension and he stays there for 1,000 years and ends up joining the Legion of Superheroes. By the way, I should mention he was also part of the Acronym Legion for a while there, too. So I think this is a fun way to use the character. I think it was clever. Again, not necessarily the execution of it, but it was cool. So, you know, if you like Valor, you know, or Mon-El or Largan, whatever the hell you want to call him this week, I mean, he was a major character in the Supergirl TV series. So that'd be worth checking out. Legion of Super, as I mentioned, is on issue 39. Valor's on number 3. They do list his first appearance as original one, Superboy number 89 from June 1961. And wow, the writer here is Robert Lauren Fleming, who, if I remember right, was writing the monthly series. And you do see an inset picture of him in, like, the traditional Mon-El costume, and then you do see him battling Eclipso, which was from the Darkness Within. And just scanning this real quickly, I don't think the name Mon-El appears anywhere in here. Actually, I think they just use Largan and Valor, if I remember right. All right, going on to the White Dragon. All right, so this is by Jan Dershima. This is another Hawkworld character. And what you've got is this person in this red and white costume, massive, massive, massive shoulder. I don't even know what you call it. They're not shoulder pads. They're like shoulder pieces. I don't know. Giant gauntlets, giant leg cuffs. It's a red and white. So the costume design, I like the bold red and white. I like the mechanics of it. And then they've got a face that it's sort of, I don't know, reminiscent of a skull, maybe, kind of in a weird kind of way. And he's got energy crackling out of his hands. It's super 90s, super 90s. So what do you think of this one?
I was confused by this because this is the spitting image of the costume that Robert Patrick wears in Peacemaker. It really is.
Oh, really?
Yes, I'm not joking.
I haven't seen Peacemaker.
I know. Oh. He dons it like a tech suit, and it looks like this. And I was like, oh, is this like a Peacemaker character? And then I looked it up, and like, it's Hawkworld. And there's no mention of Peacemaker anywhere.
What character, Robert Patrick?
Yeah.
What character did he play in Peacemaker?
He's White Dragon. He's like,
seriously, this character?
But no. I mean, he has this look and he has that name, but he's like the leader of like a white supremacist gang.
Did you not read the back of the entry? That is what this character is. Oh my God, this character.
But he's not connected to Peacemaker is what I'm saying.
No. He's not connected to Peacemaker. They just absconded with the character. Holy crap. I had no idea this character's in live action.
Yep.
That is insane.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'll tell you about Hawk World. You tell me about Peacemaker because I haven't seen it. So, all right. You get it created by credit. So, you know, John Ostrander and Jan Dracima, I hope they're getting some serious bank from HBO Max. They got a creator credit. That's awesome for them. My note says another forgotten Hawk World character, but how funny. So, all right, he's got, in the comic, he had fire powers. And he basically transforms into fire, and the fire is in the shape of a human form. But he wanted to sort of trick everyone. So he puts on this sort of white and red superhero-looking costume because he wants everyone to think he's a big, nice, cool superhero. He's posing as a traditional superhero because in reality, yes, he's a white supremacist. He was a member of the Nazi Party. He's a member of the KKK. He wants to start a race war. So he tries to become a traditional hero specifically to become accepted. So then he can subtly spread his racist message to the large majority. And in the story, Hawkman and Hawkwoman, they actually end up teaming up with their Golden Age counterparts for the story to defeat him. And the way he uses his armor is, again, he's just this burning cauldron of energy. So he wears the armor to make everyone think he's a tech hero. But the reality is when he shoots blasts, he's actually like firing out parts of his body out of it. And when he flies, it's like he's using his own energy rather than it from something from the suit. Again, the entry here written by John Ostrander. The border is black. First appearance is Hawkworld number 27, which is only 3 issues ago. Enough about that. Tell me about Peacemaker.
Well, in Peacemaker, Peacemaker's dad, Christopher Smith's dad, he's not like he has no supernatural powers. He's just a dude who is like a super tech genius, and he's built all the helmets for Peacemaker and stuff. Okay. And then he has this separate armor suit that he climbs into because Robert Patrick is older now, and they kind of sell that he's a lot older and he's out of shape and whatever. And so, but he climbs into this suit, and it gives him. He's basically Iron Man. He's like big racist Iron Man at that point.
So I'm looking at the pictures of Adam online now. Oh my God!
Yeah, yeah. So I only imagine James Gunn, when he was working on The Suicide Squad, was rifling through some databases or maybe even who's and just saw this, and the name White Dragon and the fact that he is a white supremacist was like, oh, that's enough. And he was able to just graft it into Peacemaker. But he has no connection to Hawkman. He has no magical powers. He is just a regular dude who has has this suit.
I'm looking at online a page called Comic Icons, and they literally have this Who's Who page literally right next to the Robert Patrick costume.
All right.
That is a trip, people. Yeah.
When I got to it, I was like, wait, what? So
that is insane. I hope John Ostrander and you know, maybe that's part of the connection is, you know, John Ostrander was the Suicide Squad guy, right?
That's true. Yep.
And for, you know, for all I know, maybe White Dragon appeared in a Suicide Squad issue later. I have no idea. But wow, that is crazy. All right, folks, let us know in the comments. Did White Dragon appear in the Suicide Squad comics? Or is this just a situation where maybe James Gunn was just following the John Ostrander trail? I don't know. Super fun. All right, so last entry, a little bit of a whimper to go out on. But Paul Hicks. But it's Yankee Doodle Dandy from the Doom Patrol. Now, at this point, you know, we know Doom Patrol is like off the rails insane at this point, right? Grant Morrison is just letting the crazy shit pour out of his hands under the page. So this is the only entry like that in the whole book, though, whereas before we got, you know, several Doom Patrol entries. So this one just kind of, it almost stands out for its weirdness, like, you know, not in a good way, though. So the character is a guy who's basically naked. He looks like he's wearing a diaper, and he's got some strange strings around each one of his appendages, like his feet, each ankle and his wrist or whatever. And the key is, though, his face. He's got a faceless mask. He doesn't have a face. And he's got stuff that he's just stuck to it, like he's got some hair sticking out through the mask. He's got handles on the side of his face. He's got Scrabble tiles for eyes. He's got a comb like you'd comb your hair with for a mouth or a mustache. It's very strange. The idea is, well, first I should ask you about the art. So he's standing there hunched on a building at Rob. He's got these seven heads floating around him, which are really there. It's not just in his head. They're really there. And in the background, you see Nobody, which is obviously Mr. Nobody. Mr. Nobody for president, and this is Dada. And so he's there obviously looking at a rally for Nobody for president. So, and the Yankee Doodle Dandy is patriotic colors. What do you think of this entry? The artwork here. It's Stan Walk.
I got to say, from the first time I saw it, or, you know, after not having seen it for 20 years, between the name and the background and the character design, I was sure this was from Shade the Changing Man.
Oh, okay.
Because it just has that Shade the Changing Man flavor. Nobody for president. Yankee Doodle Dandy. And, you know, ooh, everything's grim and we're the blah, blah, blah. And then I'm like, oh, it's Doom Patrol. You know, but yeah, I mean, it's a cool design. I don't, other than reading the entry, I had no idea what this is about. I wasn't reading Doom Patrol. But it's just sort of funny. I was positive it was Shade the Changing Man. I'm like, oh, Shag's going to ask me about Shade the Changing Man again. And then I'm like, oh, no, it's Doom Patrol. Okay.
Did you read the trade paperback I mailed you?
Yes, I did.
Liar. You have not.
I absolutely did.
Hey, what'd you think?
It was okay.
You suck. All right. So the thing that stands out to me in this entry is that this guy has access to the exact same technology that the question uses. So he has the spray on, you know, whatever it's called. There's a word for it. Pseudoderm. He's got the same mask that the question used. And he was like an agent for the Pentagon. He worked for a group called the Pentagon's Unusual Operatives Division. And he was a master of disguise, and he would make his face disappear just like the question. He would go off on missions. I do love that the pen he uses is like one of those where the you would turn it upside one day and the girl's clothes would fall off, and turn it the other way and they slide back down in the water.
Or one of those pens, yeah.
Yeah. But so what? It's almost like Grant Morrison wanted to write, you know, what if the question went crazy kind of story, and then realized they were doing that already, so he had to make up his own version. So so this guy, this Yankee Doodle Dandy character, is essentially like the question, disappears in the Pentagon basement for a number of years, which is, we've heard a lot about the Pentagon basement and a lot of these Who's Who entries with Doom Patrol. And now he has resurfaced, and he's been transformed into this skulking, reclusive character with the seven heads floating around him and all that stuff. It's totally bizarre. Yeah, I'll just leave it at that. So, Paul. Red Border for Hero. First appearance is Doom Patrol number 51. Right now they're on 62, so it's 11 months ago was his first appearance. Written here by Mark Waid, so that must have been interesting for Mark to get to write this one. And, you know, if you want more of the Doom Patrol freaking TV show, you know, or Waiting for Doom podcast, it's just crazy. So that's where we end it. Then we get some letters from people who wrote in. So I got to ask you, Rob, as I do every issue, so what
I do want to mention there is one comment where it says, who's dead, what's what, and where's where are all ideas that have been bandied about here in the DC offices. Now, I know they're just saying Bob Kahan here is not saying that they got further than that, other than just a bunch of editors shooting the shit coming up. But can you imagine what would what's what even be? Like, how what is it, objects? What would that even have been?
I'm thinking like Batman's utility belt. And
how crushingly boring would that series have been?
I mean, are you kidding?
What?
Elliot Brown probably bought three houses. And if you guys know the name, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, he did all the schematics for Marvel.
Exactly. He did all the schematics. He did the Punisher's Arsenal books or whatever they were called. Where it's just
and weren't those pinnacles of comic book achievement?
Sold a lot of comics, man.
I know. I'm just saying, a whole book of what? Batman's utility belt, the Mother Box, you know, Guardian Shield. I mean, what? Okay. Like, what is there really to talk about?
You laugh. Tell me right now you wouldn't have bought it.
Well, of course I would have, because it was
okay. There you go.
But that doesn't count. I'm an idiot. Doesn't count.
Now, to be fair, he is just referencing what Stephen Etherton wrote in his letter, because those were ideas proposed by Stephen Etherton. So there's no guarantee that those were specific things they were thinking about. But yeah, they obviously
it's just a random idea. I like Who's Dead, though. I mean, that Marvel did that. The handbook.
The Book of the Dead.
So that would have been fun. So,
well, it's funny. I would love to say, and maybe Cisco will do it someday, to go through the Book of the Dead and just go, okay, how many of these people are no longer dead? You know. So, all right. So I ask you every issue, what are your favorite entries in the issue?
Okay. Well, clearly Black Mask. I mentioned that the first one.
All right.
I think that one's
Did not rate for me, but okay.
Cerberus, just by concept.
Oh my God.
Love Cerberus. Just a great idea. Heckler, because it's outrageous. You know, it's like, that's fun. Legionnaires for pure art.
Yes.
Just, you know, on that same criteria, Mr. Z, the character I don't care about, but the artwork is, it's Jerry Ordway. I mean, come on.
Okay.
Those are pretty much my favorites.
Okay. So my favorites were Legionnaires and Heckler and Azrael. Those were my favorites. And then like the second tier, like the also rans, if you will, was Agent Liberty, Eclipso, Black Condor, and Timberwolf. And a lot of that is, I realize it, a lot of that is more, I just enjoyed reading those comics. So these entries excited me, but, there you go. So those are the entries. All right, folks. Well, we have been talking. Yeah. But we've been going a while. So now we are going to take a quick podcast promo break. And when we come back, we're going to get to your feedback from Who's Who in the DC Universe, number 16.
Welcome to the world of tomorrow.
The Legion of Superheroes through the Silver Age, the Bronze Age, the Baxter series, 5 years later, the reboot, the three-boot, the retro-boot, the animated series. We have banded together as the Legion of Super Bloggers to cover it all. Seek us out at legionofsuperbloggers.blogspot.com.
Always have to say it that way.
Haven't you ever heard of a little thing called showmanship?
Imagine a podcast that celebrates the things we love. Why spend time being so angry and cynical about our fandoms? Join me, the Irredeemable Shag, for a show where we're just trying to be happy. The Once Upon a Geek Podcast. Our discussions focus on a variety of geeky subjects that we're passionate about. While the topics will be ever-changing, our focus will be on science fiction, comic books, what it means to be a geek in this world, and other nostalgia-fueled ideas. Life is short. Focus on the positive. Find your joy. The Once Upon a Geek Podcast, part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
All right, we're back with your who's, who, hows, and whys. So we're going to start off with some iTunes reviews that came in. Thank you so much, folks, for leaving those because, you know, it really does help raise the profile of the show. And it seems every month or two, we get new people who are finding the show for the first time that love Who's Who just as much as us. So we really appreciate those reviews, and please keep them coming. All right, so first up is Plain Song 1987. He writes, or she, I don't know. I'm sorry. They write, why I love the DC Universe. They say, this podcast reminds me why I love the DC Universe. In 1988, I received a comic book collection from one of my mom's coworkers. The collection had a little bit of everything. Crisis, Secret Wars, Amazing Heroes, Ohotmu, and every copy of Who's Who. I used to spend hours poring over the entries in Who's Who, memorizing the characters' histories and the art. The art was... It says the art was and is so amazing. Reminder of what has made DC so great from the gold, silver, and bronze age. For anyone who appreciates DC nostalgia and listening to Shag murder Monsieur Mala's name every time he says it, this podcast is for you. All right. Oh my gosh. So I read this comment, right? So I looked up how to pronounce Monsieur and found out that's how you say it.
Mm-hmm.
I have been saying it wrong my entire life, or as long as I've been reading comic books. Why didn't anyone tell me this before now? I've been saying Monsignor Malal or I always call him Monsignor Malal or whatever. And no one has ever corrected me to my knowledge. I can't believe this, people. I blame all of you.
It's funnier just to laugh behind your back when you're done. That's why.
That's how I imagine most conversations between you and I go. Huh?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
All right. What do you got?
We got a comment from Frank Benny with the subject line, who cares, which initially scared me when I saw that. But he says, I found this podcast at the beginning of the pandemic, and I've been listening through all of the episodes. So much fun. Reminds me of the before times when I would meet up with my friends and have serious talks, about the characters, artists, and stories. This podcast is my nightly listening while working or cleaning. Great job, Robin Shag. Thank you, Frank. And non-evil Frank, thank you.
And thank you both for those iTunes reviews. We really, really appreciate it. Now, folks, we're going to get into your feedback from Who's Who in the DC Universe number 16. We're going to be, I remember, because of the volume of comments we've been getting, 80, I'm not exaggerating, 80 comments on the last issue of 16. Oh my gosh. Now, only 75% of those were Frank. Anyway, Diablo Frank. Anyway, we're only pulling the comments from the website, iTunes reviews, and email. So we won't be pulling social media. We will recognize those people at the end for shares and likes and all that. But so if you want to be included in the feedback, be sure to put your comment on our website. Rob, you want to kick us off?
All right. First up is Matt Sorois, who says, wow, what an incredible journey. It's fitting that you fellows are wrapping up Who's Who in the DCU, just as DC has finally started to reprint this stuff. I've recently purchased the massive Who's Who omnibus hardcover that collects most of the material published in the original volumes, the 87-88 updates, and the annuals from 89. Unfortunately, the characters from Atari Force have been edited out, though they still appear in the reprinted covers. Ironically, Atari Force member Blackjack's entry was reprinted in the book. He's still present in the makeup section at the end of 26. The character they originally forgot to include ends up being the character they neglected to edit out.
There's some real irony in that, isn't there? Okay. Then we got a comment from some sexy devil named Shag. This is my own comment. Because I said, in this episode, Rob and I speculate on the artist arrangement for Major Victory. Well, I reached out to Jerome K. Moore and Ray McCarthy, who worked on the piece. I complimented them, and they were incredibly generous to respond with a bunch of information. So I wanted to share that with you folks here. So Ray McCarthy wrote, to be honest, Jerome K. Moore handled Major Victory himself, and I just did the background. This is probably one of my very first inking pieces. I was a bit heavy-handed, and Jerome was fantastic as always. Then Jerome wrote, and I'm just going to read you bits of it because it's a lot. He wrote a tremendous amount. He was so kind and so generous sharing all this information. He shared actually artwork, which because of the way the internet works and it's been a year, that picture's not even available anymore. But just amazing. So he says, bless your kind heart, Shag, but this was an uncomfortable memory for me. Haha, I'm a bit of a perfectionist, which led me to learning to ink my own pencil work after many collaborations that just didn't achieve what I originally intended. I was never fast at drawing once I left New York, and my pencil lines are very tight. This often squeezed the deadline for the ink artist. Unfortunately, in addition to the differences in art styles, whereby an inker with a heavier hand couldn't mesh with my delicate lines and textures. But the tables were turned once I inked my own in this Who's Who entry. My vision for the splash piece was just too grand, and that involved that it forced Michael Urie to demand that I turn in the piece unfinished or have the entry deleted entirely from the book. Thankfully, Ray McCarthy galloped to the rescue to finish off the background inks. Wow. So he's got some more information here, too. Now, keep in mind, Jerome K. Moore was drawing Batman and the Outsiders when the 4th of July first appeared. So he's a co-creator, essentially, of these characters. So he goes on, we had called out the powers and just thought that things were a little strange. And he goes, yes, the entry's text describes Victory's power set erroneously. Originally, for his debut appearance alongside the 4th of July and Batman and the Outsiders Annual Number 1, I designed Victory as a sort of DC's answer to Captain America, as combined with Christopher Reeve. In addition to enhanced physical abilities, his super suit generated powerful energy fields, allowing him to fly and to emit tremendous bursts of light and concussive force. In flight, Victory literally appears as a shooting star. That is so cool. What a great imagery. And then he says, back in 1985, Henry Canals and I hoped to pitch a new comic book series to DC, which would have featured Major Victory as a temporary adversary for a brand new team of superheroes. Sadly, we never completed the pitch, and Hank went on to great heights in the corporate ranks of DC, while I eventually ventured into the animation field. Still, one way or another, I plan to revisit this character. Wow. So again, there's more to it. You guys can go out to our website and check out those comments, but thank you so much to Jerome K. Moore for sharing all that information.
Yeah, that was awesome. That was amazing to hear all that.
Yeah, and the artwork, and I'm really bummed that the artwork's no longer showing, because it's complicated the way you post images on the world, and it timed out or something. But it was a really cool piece, and it had Major Victory in there. He looked a lot like Christopher Reeve. They had the bad guy in there, which looked like the Master from Doctor Who. It was just freaking cool.
We got a comment from James Williams, who just simply says, congratulations on reaching such an amazing milestone, and thank you for 9 years of amazing episodes. Oh, my God, 9 years.
You're welcome, James, and now we're at 10.
Oh, my God.
Then we heard from Dr. Ange from the Supergirl blog, Comic Box Commentary, and the Legion of Superbloggers. He says, specifically about Black Lightning, I had, one of us had asked about a bit in his history that talks about how he had given up trying to be a superhero because somebody had died. And we questioned where that was. And Ange says the girl dying story was in continuity in DC Comics number 16. As he tries to stop a robbery, the crooks fire off shots indiscriminately hitting an innocent girl nearby. So there you go. That's where that came from. Then he goes on about Catwoman. He goes, one of my favorite pages in the issue. I love Brian Selvig's as well. It's just wonderful. And love this old school outfit. He says, I know I'm in the minority, but I think Silver St. Cloud is Batman's one true pairing. Some of that might be how Marshall Rogers drew her, however. Because we had a conversation last time where I wanted to know who you thought Batman's one true pairing was, and you just kind of went, for like 5 minutes and then said, I can answer that. We just moved on. So
that's not what I said, but
okay. I just listened to it this week. So, all right. Then he talks about the Matrix Supergirl. And if anyone's going to dress Supergirl, it needs to be Ange, right? Because, he's the Supergirl guy. He goes, this is when Supergirl again became a recurring character, but this is still in a very bad period of Supergirl's representation of the comic world. He talks about a lot of her history, and then he goes on to say she becomes the creepy love interest of Lex Luthor, completely manipulated and under her thumb. For me, it is only once Funeral for a Friend happens that she finally finds herself and becomes a hero. Yeah, I would totally agree with that, Ange. And then he says, if you want a deep dive, I did a series of posts called Matrix Monday on my site that reviewed the character's development closely. Still, I was glad that the concept of Supergirl returned at this point, and it was a nice pick by Dusty Abel. And then finally, about Talia, he says, I can't believe that Shags never read the original Ra's al Ghul storyline. Amazing. I think several things make her Batman's potential one true pair. For one, Ra's is the other side of the Batman coin, an extremely competent, intelligent, and organized person with an insane dedication. It is Ra's who says that Batman is only worthy of being a successor and worthy of Talia. In those early stories, Talia is sort of rejecting her father for Batman, perhaps showing that she isn't her father's pawn. So she is the best of both worlds. Ultimately, she becomes very Ra's-like, meaning she's now the other side of the Batman coin. And you can see how those two would have a lot in common outside her killing. Plus, let's face it, she's extremely attractive. She looks like Caroline Monroe. And then DC Dave chimes in about as far as the one true pairing, talking about Catwoman versus Talia. DC Dave says, I'm firmly in the Catwoman camp. DC has had Bruce and Selina together since the 1970s. The Batman and Catwoman of Earth 2, and of course, Helena Wayne Huntress. Catwoman has been there since almost the beginning as a foil for Bruce, but not an evil one. And he says, Ange, you mentioned Caroline Monroe in regard to Talia. I will say in regard to Catwoman, Eartha Kitt, Julie Newmar, and Lee Merriweather. it's a lot of sexiness going on in that sentence, I would say, Rob. What do you think?
We can add Zoe Kravitz to that.
There we go. Yeah. That's true.
Movie wasn't out when they wrote this last time.
That's true.
I love Ange, but he's wrong. As I said, it can't be Talia. She murders people. That's just no. Batman's like, no.
But it doesn't mean they have to live happily ever after. It just means who is the one Batman should be with, not necessarily is with.
I'm saying Batman would not be attracted to a woman that does that.
I don't care. Okay.
Right. Like whatever. So
everyone's got a thing for bad girls. All right, go ahead.
Okay. He's Batman. Okay. All right. Let's move on. Chuck Coletta says, I don't know if this is relevant to your discussion on why Batman's role with the Outsiders is excised from the Black Lightning entry. He says, when we organized our Batman and Pop Culture Conference in 2019, Tony Isabella had agreed to be one of our guest speakers. Around this time, DC announced that they were relaunching a new version of Batman and the Outsiders. Tony emailed me soon after and said he would no longer participate in the event, and an event connected to any DC hero besides Black Lightning. He was apparently incensed that it seemed to him that Black Lightning would be taking orders from a white man as Batman would be team leader. He sees this as antithetical to Black Lightning. I would have thought getting your, at the time, lower profile hero in a Batman book would be a good thing. Perhaps he was angry that his recent Black Lightning relaunch had faltered a year or so earlier. In any event, he's been a very nice guy on the couple of occasions when I've spoken to him, and I'd love to bring him to our campus to speak someday. We had to scramble to find another guest, and luckily Dan Mishkin, a BGSU alum, was available. Isabella's relationship with DC has been very fraught over the decades, and he's very protective over his creation. I don't know if removing mentions of Batman from the Black Lightning entry was influenced by this relationship, but could be. Wow. Thank you, Chuck, for that behind-the-curtain story.
Interesting. Very interesting. Okay. And I want to say, I think that particular conference was the one, because they mentioned Dan Mishkin, so I think that's the one where Dr. Jennifer Schwartz Levine and our friend Stella both presented at that same conference.
Oh, wow. Cool.
Yep. All right. Michael Bailey from the Fortress of Bailey 2 Podcasting Network, he writes in to say, another milestone reach, which makes me think that Milestone should have gotten its own Who's Who series. And you know what? I'll tell you what. That would have made more sense than Impact. But anyway. All right. Mike says, about Krypton, I heartily recommend that World of Krypton miniseries that Shag mentioned. The post-crisis Krypton gets a bad rap for being sterile. And in the words of Wendy Pingy, a planet that deserved to be blown up. But when Byrne fleshed out the backstory, there's a lot going on. Political intrigue, cloning, incest, the fact that the terrorist group Black Zero were ultimately responsible for Krypton's destruction. It's really cool. It's kind of like, as Rob would say about the New Gods, it's Game of Thrones in space. Plus, it had great Mike Mignola artwork. Yeah, that series was great. I mean, I couldn't care less about Krypton. But when I read that miniseries, I was like, well, that's pretty damn interesting. Then he says about Rampage. Mike is a Rampage stan, folks. So hear him out. He says, yes, she's got a lot of She-Hulk's DNA in her as a character, but I will always love this character. Roger Stern picked up a lot of the threads that Byrne left after leaving the book and made them work. Kitty Faulkner, that is, meaning Rampage, was one of them, which is why I'm always annoyed when Rampage is thrown in as a background villain in a comic or animated movie. That's not her function. She was never a bad guy. definitely one of my favorite Superman side heroes. Totally agree. You know, I loved her in the Starman series. So that's where my love for her grew, Mike. But yeah, I'm right there with you, buddy.
Can I make a comment about Krypton for a second?
Just no.
Oh, all right. Let's move on.
Go ahead.
My argument with that in general and why I don't think prequels work for the most part is I feel like it makes, in this specific instance, Superman less interesting if the place that he came from is like its own super involved drama. To me, it makes Superman more interesting if what he came from is not all that interesting. He's interesting. You know what I mean? It's almost like, well, if everything is interesting, then it's all just kind of one big story and there's no special. It's kind of like, and I don't mean to get into this, but it's almost like, I know there's like that Ben Kenobi TV show coming out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's like, I don't want to see Ben. I know I'm a minority on this, but like, I don't want to see Ben Kenobi on Tatooine before Star Wars doing a lot of fun stuff. Cause I'm like, well, I thought the point of that was that he wasn't doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until Luke shows up that things started to get interesting. You know what I mean? It's almost like, well, if he just kept having adventures, it makes the later story that we know, aka Star Wars, less interesting. So to me, if Krypton is Game of Thrones, it makes Superman less special that he, okay, now we're just moving on to Superman. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. But
I'll say two things there. One is then you're advocating for the post-crisis Superman, Krypton being boring, yes, versus pre-crisis Superman, where Krypton was very interesting.
Which was insane, yes. That was,
okay.
Yeah, all right. Superpowers and all. Yeah, I agree. No, I think, yeah.
Everyone hear that? Rob just said crisis was necessary. So
then, not what I said, but okay.
Then I will quote, well, paraphrase. Let's put it that way. Steve Ditko. So it's apparently
this ought to be good.
So apparently Steve Ditko was being groomed to come back to Marvel for a while to do a Spider-Man book. And this is in the 90s. And they said, come on, come back. We'd love to have you. And he was on the cusp of doing it. So they sent him some modern Spider-Man books to read.
Oh,
and they sent him the Untold Tales of Spider-Man, which was done by Kurt Busiek. And I forget the artist, but it was gorgeous work. It was a great series. It was the stories that took place in between the original Amazing Spider-Man issues. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, between Amazing Spider-Man 1 and 2, there was like an adventure or something like that. And so that's what they told. It was really fun. Well, again, this is all apocryphal, guys. I don't have any truth to any of this, but supposedly Steve Ditko was incensed when he saw these issues because he's like, I didn't know Stan and I had collaborators back then. I didn't know there was all these adventures in between our stories. So it's very similar to sort of yours where it's like, you know, you don't mess with the past, buddy. And so he walked from the project. So again, I don't know if any of that's true. That's the story I've heard. It makes a damn good story, so I'll stick with it. But there you go.
I don't know if I want to ever agree with Steve Ditko on anything, really. So maybe I retract my statement. But okay. we got a comment from Nick Vector, who I said was that's probably a fake name because that just sounded like a character from like the Hacker Files or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so he wrote, "You got my number, Rob." Signed, Nikolai Victoria Torovich.
Sounds like me when I'm trying to spell which something out, right?
I'm only assuming that the Tori thing was like his version of the movie Tora 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 from the late 60s. But I appreciate the continuing with the joke, Nick.
Well, someone called him out later and reveals where the name came from. So I don't know if you highlighted that or not. We'll see if we get to it.
Oh, I don't know. We'll get to it. Okay.
Then we hear from Tom Perrin, who has his own comics blog called TP Comics Blog, where he posts his own custom Who's Who entries, guys. He did his own like Ace the Bat Hound and stuff like that. You should check it out. So, Tom wrote in the correction for the Desaad entry, cause we talked about how they reprinted entries for issue number 16. They corrected them. And I think I had said they got the border right, but he's right. He says the Desaad entry, all they did was switch the nearly invisible black logo to the very visible white logo. The border on the back was black for both. So yeah, that was the correction with the Desaad one, was that the logo is impossible to read. A little bit like a couple we saw today, but yeah, so that was the correction.
All right. Steve Givens says, first of all, Mr. Kelly, Mr. Matthews, he's so formal. I do not appreciate you assuming that I don't already have massive biceps with which to lug that enormous Who's Who omnibus at a convention. For all you know, I could have the physique of Chris Evans at the peak of his tenure as Captain America. Hey, if Shag and Nick Vector get to use fake names in this thread, there's no reason I can't have a fake physique. Yeah, but I've met Steve. He's not built.
Oh,
Chris Evans.
I was going to say, the irony is, since we recorded that episode, Steve's been in your house.
Yeah. No, if he looked like Chris Evans, I wouldn't let Kelly anywhere near him. So there's no
smart move.
So this anyway,
that's why I'm not allowed to see Kelly anymore.
That's right. Yes, that's exactly what it is. I got to remember to disinvite you from the wedding. So anyway, he says, Rob, I agree with you that one of the drawbacks of the Loose Lose format is that every character seems to be given equal weight with each entry. What made the original series such a delight was how it implied the importance of a character with an amount of space it received in the book. It was an approach that slowly emerged since Aquaman and both Batman received only a page each, but the two-page spread for The Flash, the first for a single character, if memory serves, was a clear visual signal that Barry Allen was an integral part of the DC universe. One final note, the Forever People entry is the standout in this issue for me. Technically, it is the best drawn entry, and Art Adams captures the offbeat whimsy of the group very nicely. I agree with all that, Steve.
Yeah, Art Adams, we said it before. He was really the, I hate to say unsung hero, that's probably not the right thing, but he was one of the MVPs for the Loose Leaf edition, without a doubt.
He's one of those guys that's like, have you ever seen a bad art job by Art Adams?
Exactly.
Can you ever think of one? I can't think of one.
I saw him at a convention and bought his art book, you know, because they sell like their portfolio art book. I bought it immediately, and every drawing in there is just gorgeous. And I love it because you see stuff that you don't normally see, like, oh, wow, you know, Creature in the Black Lagoon. Oh my gosh, more, please.
One other thing about Art Adams, just as I'm thinking of it.
Because this podcast isn't long enough.
That's right. Hey, we're going to do it every 6 months. I think one of the things about that is there's the whole thing with Art Adams was that they realized he was too slow to do a monthly book, right? So they would put him on special projects, the long shot that he could do all of, you know, and get done before or whatever, or like the covers, you know, and, you know, you think, well, that hurts his career because he can't do a regular book, yada, yada, yada. But then you think, but if it's a guy like that or like a Brian Bolland, right, he's only probably ever going to ink himself because they've got the extra time. So he's not subjected to, you know, the Vince Coletta's of the world. You know what I mean? Like, you're never going to see. I'm sorry to bag on Vince Coletta for the third time this month on the network, but like, you're never going to see Art Adams inked by kind of some hack guy that banged it out in a weekend. It's always going to look like Art Adams. So like, there's an advantage to being so slow that it's like, well, just let them ink themselves because what the hell? We're already not worried about a monthly deadline anyway. So I think that good part of the reason that you've never seen a bad Art Adams art job. Because he pretty much only linked himself.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, and then you get, when he, like you said, they just do special books, like those amazing, like New Mutants special he did.
Right.
And where they went to Asgard. Oh, so good.
Like Brian Bolland, you know, he does Killing Joke, and that's it. Mm-hmm. You know, he doesn't do a monthly book, and he's going to ink it himself. So that's why, again, you've never seen a bad Brian Bolland art job.
Yep, or he did, like, Animal Man covers for, God,
right,
I don't know,
exactly.
20 years or however long.
One page a month, he can do that.
Exactly. All right, then we heard from Phil, and Phil says, sorry to say, I only discovered the podcast a couple months ago, but I'm madly playing catch-up and loving it. Awesome work, guys. So glad DC finally got that massive omnibus, and I'm using this instead of my originals to read along. Gotta say, there's a few iffy things in such an inexpensive book. Not just the Atari Force, almost but not quite being deleted thing, but check out Monkle's page, weird colors. And the same sentence appears twice in the intro in two different places. And then he says, this wouldn't have happened under Brenda Pope's watch. Phil, you may be new to the show, but you're part of the family already, buddy.
I love that we've made that a thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Brenda Pope a thing. This woman has no idea that any bunch of nerds still talk about what she did 30 years ago.
Right.
Oh, it's amazing. David S. Gutierrez. All right, Shag, you have the joke highlighted. Go ahead.
He is the owner and operator of the Katana Banana, which now, by the way, has a new location in a Cynthiana, Kentucky bathroom. So that's an inside joke for about three people.
My God. Yeah, sometimes the fine water thread can be a dangerous place. So he says, this is the best gift ever, and I'm not even a mom. I guess did we put the other one out around Mother's Day?
I think we said it was a gift for him, and it did come out in May. Yeah.
Okay, May, that's what it was. Some notes as I go. First off, an abridged Batman entry is fine. Quote, mom and dad are murdered. Obsession follows. He adopts a bunch of kids and trains them. Kind of a dick. Rich, detective, cool gadgets, unquote. Done. I like that. I like the minimalist approach.
Sending that off to Tom King now. All right.
Forever People, not as bad as Rob would have you believe. I guess they have to be Omega Men. Also, didn't someone leave you a song about them?
Yes. So somewhere along the lines over the years of this show, we've had musical interludes with different stuff. Absolutely.
Yeah. And then he says, never gave two bellas about Krypton. It went boom. That's all you need to know. See, that's what I'm talking about. By the way,
you had just firmly put yourself in the camp with David Iskuder. Do you really think that's wise?
Broken clock. But I also appreciate that between him and I, we use the phrase giving bellas is a term that we use together, and I enjoy that he spread it into the Who's Who.
What the hell
Who's
is
who
that?
Feedback page. Okay, I'll explain because the show
again, another
not
story.
Long
oh
enough.
My god,
hey, I got a lot to say.
This so, one time when I worked at
have you ever, one time at Bandcamp. No, did you ever see Ed Wood, the movie Ed Wood?
I did not.
Okay, masterpiece, great movie. Tim Burton's best movie by a country mile. Mm. Absolutely masterful movie. But anyway. Bela Lugosi, who is a character in that movie, and he constantly refers to himself in the third person. He's constantly referring to him as Bela. And I won't say the word because we try to keep the show family friendly, but he talks about that he can't get work anymore. And he says, no one gives two Fs for Bela. And so ever since then, ever since Dave and I have known each other, we use Bela's as a metric of how little somebody gives about it. So I really appreciate that he says, I don't give two bellas about Krypton. Made me laugh very hard.
There's 120 seconds of my life I'll never get back. Okay.
I need to sit and listen to you talk about the Legion for 4 hours. What are you talking about?
There wasn't even that much Legion in this stupid book. They're just on the freaking cover. You kept saying it's a Legion issue. It was not.
The Iceman. Igna. Yeah, whatever.
That's not even Legion. That's acronym Legion. Those don't count. All right. Jeez. No one likes Acronym Legion. Oh, my God, I said it. All right, so then there's Symbol Pending, who does the Symbol Pending Power Girl blog. They say, try to switch things up a little bit. I will just mention poor Tanya Spears, a.k.a. Power Girl, the other one, a black character done the dirty by the last couple of reboots. Rebirth has not done my poor Power Girls any good, alas.
I have no idea who that is. I have no idea what he's talking about.
I had to look her up, but the minute I saw her picture, I remember. I'm like, oh, I do remember her. It was this young teenage African American girl who went by the name Power Girl because Power Girl herself, Kara, went over to Earth 2, and so Tiny Spears was out doing. And I remember, like, oh yeah, that was the thing for like a hot minute. So yeah. Then Symbol Pending goes on to say, did I mention that Symbol Pending has a Power Girl blog? I couldn't remember if it said that.
Yes.
Anyway.
Did.
Okay, so some film pending goes on to say, Infinity Inc. is on my list to read, and if I keep at my current pace, which is unlikely, I should hit those issues around the start of next year, just in time for the next Who's Who, apparently. well played joke, and you're not wrong. So there we go. Then we hear from Chris Franklin to the Firewater Podcast Network. He does shows such as the JLU Cast, Starman Chronicles, and many more. Chris writes in to say about Batman, despite what others may have expected, I kind of agree with Shag. Gasp! I love Norm frickin' Brayfogle, but this piece honestly disappointed me in 1991 to 1992. It just seems rushed. It has that Brayfogle energy, but I would have preferred a bit more polish for Batman's signature piece. The best two Batman Who's Who entries were Dave Gibbons on the Earth 2 Batman and Alan Davis in the 87 update. See, I'm not crazy. Yes, the Batman entry was a bit of a disappointment from that, and I hate to say that. It just it's the truth.
He also says, new challenges of the unknown. At last, someone who agrees with me on Tim Sale. I thought his art was pretty hideous from the first time I saw it here. As an aspiring comic artist about to finish high school, I felt like, hey, if this guy can get work, I'm in. Now, I will give him full credit that his artwork in Long Halloween, A Dark Victory, Superman for All Seasons, Superman looks like an inbred doofus. I'm sorry. I know the story is great, but I have a hard time getting past the art. I know a lot of folks love his stuff, and I understand I'm in the minority, and I hold no ill will against the guy, but he seems like a nice fellow. But his style just isn't for me. And I think here, before he learned to properly block his blacks and create the mood he's really good at, it showed how wonky and visually unappealing the style really is, at least on a mainstream superhero comic.
Yeah, because last episode, you just straight up said, like, Tim Sale can't draw.
It's awful. I mean, it's awful. It's absolutely awful.
Those new challengers look pretty bad. Yeah,
Tim Sale is able to look, he's gotten way better. I mean, look, there's no doubt about that.
I mean, Halloween is legendary.
Right.
At this
but
point.
I think that he is able to hide a lot of his artistic deficiencies with a lot of style. And that's not always that doesn't necessarily mean you're bad. A lot of the image artists are like that. I think Todd McFarlane is that. but that Challenger's drawing is just abysmal, and I just defy anybody to really argue otherwise.
Yeah. No, I don't think a lot of people are arguing with you. Then he comments on Phantasm. You know, I kind of geeked out on Phantasm last time because I love this character. And he says, man, I love that look. I was totally into the Titans Hunt. What a wild ride. And the first time the new Teen Titans was good in like 5 years or something. Plus, they actually managed to do something with Danny Chase that didn't suck. Tom Grumman's art is always wonderful, and this was actually after Wolfman's writer's block. Editor Jonathan Peterson re-energized Wolfman on the book, but unfortunately he left DC, and subsequent editors buried the book and this character. Yeah, you're not wrong there, Chris. Now, so there's some more comments about Phantasm I'll get to, where they did go a little wrong on the character, but I just loved his look. I thought Phantasm looked so cool.
He mentions Ambush Bug. Okay, I know this breaks Shag's heart, but I'm not the biggest Bug fan. But this is a great joke, and it lands perfectly. Great show, guys, and very happy to have you back at it. Thank you, Christopher.
Awesome, Chris. So I was going to jump on your case about Ambush Bug, but you landed it. Well done. Then we're from Lizanne Oswald, who has her own YouTube channel. Liz says, Infinity Inc. is cool, but the images, because we talked about the inset images. I'm like, wait a minute. Weren't those pulled from comic book pages rather than drawn for the entry? So Liz is agreeing with us here. She says, Infinity Inc.'s cool, though. Yeah, the images were from the comic, so were a bunch of the others. So Liz is saying that a lot of the images came from other comics. Then Liz says, yeah, DC seemed to hate Roy Thomas. First Crisis messes up all his plans, and then Infinity Inc. is shelved. And then Liz says that Hector Hall was their favorite Dr. Fate. Sorry, Shag. You know, Liz, you don't have anything to apologize for. The Hector Hall version of Dr. Fate was pretty awesome, actually. So it got no problems for me on that one. Then we're from Tom Panarese from the Pop Culture Affidavit blog and podcast. And he says about Phantasm. So here we go. So, Chris, here's the follow-up. He says, I liked the character during the Titans Hunt, but then he became the Erstat's Raven once that story ended and he was changed into something mystical. It's one of the three attempts to make Danny Chase anything more than Cousin Oliver, and it really didn't work. Neither did the idea that an alternate Earth Danny was the Teen Titans' mysterious leader until editorial changes made it Monarch. That's a little preview for next issue of Who's Who, by the way. And he says, honestly, I think people miss Danny Chase about as much as they miss Terry Long. Well played. Well played, Tom.
I would take 5 Terry Longs for a Danny Chase. I'm just saying.
Really?
Yeah. I just, okay.
Phantasm was great. Phantasm.
Paul, okay, sure. Paul Hicks from the Waiting for Doom, Dial F for Flanger, and More podcast says, Shade the Changing Man. Thoughts, Rob?
All right, in full disclosure, I'm sorry, go ahead, Rob.
That's a callback to the fact that Shag asked me what I thought of Shade the Changing Man, and I said I hadn't seen it, and then he kept asking me 6 more times every time we got to a Shade listing.
Okay. In full disclosure, I read this comment before we started recording, so that's why I asked Rob like 30 minutes ago if he'd read Change to the Changing Man. Yes. And what he thought. So, yes, I was call forwarding to this moment.
Tim Price from the Outcasters Batto podcast and the Batgirl Huntress podcast says, 2 shots of me in the first 2 entries. I was a little worried about the rest of the issue, but thank goodness that was mostly it.
But Tim, you set yourself up.
I don't know. What did we say?
It was probably Outsiders characters or something. But like, you set yourself up, man. You're cheerleading the Outsiders, so you're going to have to get some shots. That's the way it works.
I like the Outsiders too. I was a guest on that show. I don't know. I wouldn't have taken a shot at the Outsiders. I love those guys.
I listened back the other day to the episode. We were goofing around, having fun. So okay. Tim knows. Right. Tim knows. Yes. We love him. Yeah, so absolutely. They were from Eric, who has a blog called the Fish Flavored Baseball Bat Blog. As unbelievable as that is. Now Eric has some really interesting information here. It says regarding the combination of Craig Hamilton and Tony Harris on the Prince Evilo page. I believe this was Tony Harris's very first work for DC and is very early in his career. I know that Hamilton and Harris lived in the same area around the time. I attended a lot of comic conventions in Atlanta in the early 1990s, and there was an incredibly talented group of local artists who always seemed to be together at neighboring tables. Hamilton, Harris, Adam Hughes, Brian Stelfreeze, Joe Phillips, Jason Pearson. Several of them did indeed share a studio at the time. I was very lucky to have gotten sketches from so many of these artists and that early in their careers. Then he goes on to say, I think Craig Hamilton may have even been a mentor or instructor to Harris, because if you look over Harris's early career on the Grand Comic Database, I looked up the independent comic book called Blade, no connection to the Marvel character, which was Harris's first published work. Of the 2 issues that were published, issue number 2 had Hamilton credited as creative editor, with Hamilton penciling the cover and writing an introduction of the issue. My purely speculative guess is that Hamilton saw the first issue, perhaps when they were both guests at a convention, recognized Harris's talent, and offered him some guidance. Look at that. Now, some of that's factual, some of it's speculation. But either way, interesting to see the connections. Thank you so much, Eric.
Yeah, that was really interesting. Martin Gray from the Two Dangers for a Girl blog says, well, this was a surprise. I thought we'd finished. Thank you, Rob and Shag. This was a total treat, and I really do think you deserve credit for the publication of the Who's Who Omnibus. You got a buzz going after decades of the series not being talked about and kept it in the zeitgeist from there on in. It's you guys I would have autograph it, but no one writes in my books. Shag, I get that you have, I love that he abbreviates this, WWTDDOTDCU.
Oh my gosh. So who's who, the definitive director of the DC Universe? Wow.
But it's not the same as having the omnibus. It is magnificent, as he says. I'm sure it is. I want to get it at some point, but I just haven't dropped the money on it.
I said it before. I'll say it again. Guys, I own the originals. Yeah. I bought them on Comixology. I own the digitals. I pay the monthly annual subscription fee to the DC Unlimited. I have those. You know, how many times can I buy these comics before my wife divorces me? You know, and it's not like I can smuggle
an omnibus. Let's test that out. That'd be kind of a fun thought experiment.
No. It's not like I can smuggle an omnibus in the house and she not notice. So, yeah, guys, it's saving my marriage not owning that thing.
All right. Note to self, send book to Shaq.
Remember, I'm going to be at your wedding, so you better step carefully.
We are trying to pare down the list, so every person we can shave
off. Oh my gosh!
Weddings are expensive, and you Patreon people are not stepping up. So anyway, Martin continues.
Not true. Unless you've got a separate Patreon just for your wedding, then that's just
a good
sad.
Idea.
That's just sad.
I should do that. All right. So anyway, we're trying to sponsor the wedding like rich people do. We're trying to get in-stock trades involved, but it hasn't worked out yet.
I'm looking forward to the goodie bag.
Yeah. All right. It's going to be old issues of the human fly. So
like a dog shampoo and perfume. Like, what the hell is all this? I don't know. They sponsored.
All right, let's continue. So Martin Gray continues on. He says, the new Challenge of the Unknown, heavy Rob sigh from me. Character redesigns are abominations. The series was terrible too. One of those runs by a creative team who loved the original concept so much, they tear it to ribbons. Two members killed. The others reduced to gnarly, unstable sad sacks. This is, I think that was for you, Shag.
It was, it's Capitals.
Yeah, it's the Capitals, yeah. This is the point at which Tim Sale and Jeff Loeb should have been politely patted on the head and invited to work on their own creation. Great. And then he says that Rob is so right about Talia, pure pants. I don't exactly know what that means, but I know
it's a British thing. It's rubbish,
a British thing. No, it's not good. And her running Lex Luthor's businesses as Talia Head is as stupid as Black Lightning being Secretary of Education. When did she have time to go to business school? She was far too busy trained to be an assassin and an all-around tart.
Oh, my gosh.
Martin dropping some truth bombs over here. It's pretty rough. What?
And I just last issue was cheerleading Black Lightning as a Secretary of Education, and now he's, wow, he's coming at me full guns. Man. Yep.
And then Ange wrote back and he says to Martin, you described Talia as sex, scent, and Turkish delight, as if that's a bad thing. It's not a bad thing.
Oh, gosh. All right. Next comment. All right, folks. I have been waiting for this comment for years, literally. When we finished Who's Who and we started getting into the Loosely, I tasked Jeff R. Jeff R. has been a commenter since probably the beginning. I don't know. Millions of years he's been writing into the show. And Jeff R., through the original Who's Who, would always give us our egregious omission of the issue because, you know, there was alphabetical. And then when we started the Loose Leaf back in, I don't know, 1972, Jeff said, hey, guys, I'm not going to do it for the Loose Leaf because every issue was a whole new alphabet. He goes, I'm going to wait to the end, and then I'll say who the egregious omissions were. So here we are. Jeff promised me this. I think we started, 2018, 2019? So, I mean, it's that many years. So, thank you so much, Jeff. I'm so excited. He goes, okay, as promised, here are the egregious omissions for the first Loose Leaf of Who's Who. Goes, now, with some categories, I could go on forever. There's lots of events that could be added, from the recent War of the Gods to the Janus Directive to giving an account of what post-crisis was like. But let's concentrate on characters. And most of these characters were on the edge, ones that might have been used more if they'd been remembered in a Who's Who page. Counting down, number five is Godiva, not the Global Guardian, but the Titan's foe. She had a big splashy debut in the annual and then barely appeared afterward. A page here in another world, she might have been a beloved anti-hero today. Interesting. Wasn't she the one? No, wait, I'm thinking of Shimmer. So I can't remember what Godiva looked like. Interesting. Okay.
No, me neither.
Then number four, OMAC. I have no idea why he didn't make it with a John Byrne project right in the time frame and being a Kirby creation. Wow, that's a good point. That definitely should have been in here. Number three, Triangle, the supporting cast character. This was the CIA agent seen in Sandman and Swamp Thing Annual Number 5, one of his creations mostly connected to the DCU as Element Girl's handler in interacting with Firestorm. Could have been a bigger thing going forward. Interesting. Good call. Number two, Paradox, another villain that made their debut in an annual, in this case, Flash Armageddon 2001 annual. The story gave her interesting powers and a lot of backstory with Wally during the 10 years between 1991 and 2001. If he hadn't been forgotten, we might have seen some interesting stories. And number one, see, Jeff knows who the audience is.
Oh, man,
is
he was
to.
Buttering you up like a Sunday biscuit.
This all makes sense. Number one, Cliff Carmichael, who may have been mentioned offhandedly in the Suicide Squad entry, but needed a full page. He never got the code name, although Ostringer flirted with calling him Thinker 2 or Cyberpunk. And the story left him alive. With his mind control powers, which was disabled by Oracle by her super intelligence but his super intelligence was fully intact. I've always thought it was odd that in more than 100 issues of Birds of Prey, Oracle never again had to face her first nemesis under that identity. That's interesting. So, and think about Cliff Carmichael. I mean, he was in the Suicide Squad at the time. He had been around in Firestorm. It would have made sense. I'm with him on that. But then this is where I love Jeff forever. He goes, but here's an explanation. See, in about the 15 years later, there's a story called Countdown. And in it, Maxwell Lord is a supervillain, a sociopath with a grudge against metahumans and mental powers of total control. There's always been a problem with that story. Max isn't a sociopath. He doesn't have anything against metahumans, and his powers never work that way. Cliff Carmichael, on the other hand. So that's the theory slash fix. Cliff is clearly impersonating Max. Maybe Max is alive, maybe he's not. Maybe Cliff escapes and Wonder Woman kills someone else. It's a pretty useless little theory for two continuities down the line, unless someone else wants to do a role-playing set in that era with JLI characters. So I love that idea that Max wasn't Max and it could have been Cliff Carmichael. That would work great. I'm totally on board with that. But thank you so much for the egregious submissions. Jeff Tischer does chime in with a couple of more, though. He says, while I understand wanting to highlight some of the side characters that were sidelined, there were two major characters and one major team that were omitted, and that was a travesty. Captain Marvel, the Atom, and Justice League Europe. Why these three never made it into the loose leaf boggles my mind. Good calls. So thank you so much, Jeff R. and Jeff T.
It occurs to me that we just hit 3 hours of this episode and we haven't even gotten to Frank's comments yet. Anyway, Mike Dinah says, the Forever People again? What's next? Who's who of the Omega Men? You laugh, Mike. I would have bought that.
I'm gonna do one of those flashback episodes all about Omega Men. That's coming next.
It would be awesome. That'll be our lowest rated show. Challengers of the Unknown. The best part of this entry was Rob losing it on these putzes. I like the characters. I wouldn't call them putzes. And he says, well done on this fun episode. And to the 9 years, you two have been consistently fun and you've gotten better every episode. That's clearly not true. I've enjoyed all the shows you put out. I can't wait to hear what comes next. Keep up the great work. Bring on the impact.
There we go. See, we got a cheerleader. Awesome. Then we're from Captain Entropy. Goes, this podcast is a big part of what hooked me on the network and introduced me to the other crazy nerds like me. I'm glad it's still around. It comes out every now and then. Oh, there you go, Captain Entropy. This is a little present for you. He goes, not to be all frank about it, but I reject the whole concept of one true pairing. Look, you got a friend. Compatibility is necessary but insufficient. As long as both partners are emotionally healthy and mature and practice good relationship skills that demonstrate love and respect, there may be many viable pairings. And yes, I do remember we're talking about Batman. So let's assume it's a Steve Englehart or Alan Brennert version and go through the options. So I'll hit this real quick. He says, Silver St. Cloud, she's wonderful, and we all kind of love her. Now, that smoking thing notwithstanding. But she doesn't want to wait up every night and wondering if Bruce will come home wounded, whole, or not at all, and I wouldn't want to make her feel that way. All right. Then Talia, current crazy aside, I can't see her recalibrating her moral compass to Batman without a radical life event. She's too comfortable with her father's methods and objectives, and Batman certainly won't meet her halfway. Then Selina Kyle. She's far more compatible than Talia. She steals, she doesn't kill, and at least not often. She and Bruce might be able to find some middle ground as they effectively have in the past, but she may never respect the law and traditional authority to even a very limited degree that Bruce does. None of these seem perfect, but wait! There's a late entry from the animated universe. Princess Diana of Themyscira. The Ambassador and the Tycoon. The ultimate power couple. Similar ideas on right and wrong, service to others, and when to break a few eggs to make the omelet. Similar world similar world-class standing in both of their identities, and it would do Bruce good to let some light in and let someone else lead once in a while. A wonderful choice indeed. You know, I do like the idea of pairing Batman with Wonder Woman. I like the way they've explored it, but I just don't think I could handle it on an ongoing basis. Batman's just too much of a dick. Like, I just can't see it. That's just me.
Yeah, I was never a huge I was never a huge fan of that. Michael Kramer says, I could be wrong, but I believe that the animated Justice League two-parter In Blackest Night is actually based on a two-part Bronze Justice League story, issues 140 to 141. The story centers around Hal being tricked into believing he destroyed a world through a power beam of his ricochet. I think people confuse it with Cosmic Odyssey because of what happened in that story being so similar, and with the animated episode featuring John, since Hal was not an active core member in the Timeverse. Thank you, Michael.
All right. That's a good point. Well, that's interesting to think about there. All right, folks. We are now at the point of the show where we get to Diablo Frank of the Rolled Spine Podcast Network. Frank has written many manifestos in the history of this show. I just want to point this. Right. Yes. All the above.
Screams. I'd like to...
You're not going to let me get this out, are you? I'd like to point out that I compile this Google document every time we get together. And this one is 33 pages long, guys. 33 pages. That is insane. It's at like at what, 1 point font, Rob? It's really small. Anyway, it's 33 pages. And I kid you not, pages 18 through 29 are all Frank. Holy shit, Frank. You went full on, man. You just went full crazy, brother. He wrote 8,500 words. I mean, this is a testament to one man's dedication to pissing us off. So thank you so much, Frank. You are a master, sir. There's so much meat in here. I'm just going to touch on a few things, folks. I'm going to kick off with this rant that I just think is absolutely amazing. He says, the Who's Who podcast has been deferred for so long that it's like that elderly relative in whose will you know you are named. When you're young and hungry, as much as you love and cherish Wawa, now, see, keep in mind, Frank's from the South. He might be confused. Don't confuse the convenience store. He's talking about Wawa being your grandma. So when you're young and hungry and as much as you cherish Wawa, you could really use that bequeathment. And as the years have gone on and your contacts with Wawa have become so few and far between and your personal situation is stabilized while becoming insular, there's that an estrangement. You only hear about Wawa when it gets out of its lock unit and the old folks home and wanders the streets, sending your now aging parents and ailing parents into a panic that concerns you more for their well-being than demented non-Agerian Wawa. 9 years going on in a decade with something like a bi-yearly schedule, then sudden unanticipated appearance of Who's Who episodes provoke alarm, anxiety, and a sense of implosion. Christ, is Who's Who going to turn up in a ditch? I've got to drop everything and do an emotionally analytical comment thread despite barely doing it anymore and being broadly burned out. Do I have the PTO flexibility to attend the funeral? I started the Marvel Handbook in anticipation of carrying on the legacy of Who's Who, but abandoned it over a year ago until I'm ready to deal with it again because Wawa's clearly going to malinger on for years yet. With multiple damned Impact series, for F's sake, will they devote a couple of years to the artistic legacy of the mighty effing Crusaders? I laugh so freaking hard at that. And so did Captain Entropy. So thank you so much, Frank. You are an insane bastard. Rob's left, by the way. Rob went off.
Yeah, I mean, you got a lot more to read, buddy. So
I'm trying not to slow you down. I'm going to go through as fast as I can. Then he talks about Batman. He says, Batman was one of my primordial superheroes, the gateway to my love of the medium. He was an early favorite in comics by Jim Aparo and Neil Adams. In the animation, in the films with Adam West, I intentionally, if intermediately or sporadically, bought his books up until the early 1990s and dove in deep with Nightfall, but all but gave up somewhere around Night's End. I liked a lot of the interpretations of the character up till about Jim Starlin, but the Alan Grant, Doug Mensch, Chuck Dixon writing team, and Denny O'Neill's editorial stewardship killed it for me. I could go over all the moral implications about not letting the Joker be killed, or his stunted emotional development, or his abusive relationship with his inner circle, or his inability to be a healthy parent or partner, and that would all be valid. However, it finally occurred to me today that he's just lost all his charm. He's boring. Nothing of substance will ever occur within his sphere, and he will never evolve. He's not funny, he's not often very smart, and I simply do not derive any pleasure from his company. He is to comics as I am to comment threads. Why would anyone want to spend their time with an aggressively antisocial, hypercritical Debbie Downer like him? He is quite simply the Zack Snyderist superhero. You know, Frank, everyone goes through their Batman phase. So I get it, man. And I do not disagree with a lot of what you said there. So then it talks about Brian Stelfreeze. Now, Brian Stelfreeze did the Catwoman entry last time, Rob. And I was cheerleading it, and you were like, bah, I don't like it. So he writes, I love Stelfreeze, one of the unheralded greats. His Catwoman competes with Dave Stevens, and Shag needs to slap the crystal meth out of Rob's hands. There is no one true pairing for Batman because his greatest kink is punching mentally imbalanced geeks in the teeth. Training children soldiers gets him off in a way no woman ever could. So, wow. All right. I am now scrolling through 8 pages looking for the next comment I highlighted, and I did read it all. Holy crap. All right, here we go. Jerome K. Moore should have been huge. Completely agree, Frank. Like Craig Hamilton, he should have gotten only the best inkers and the most prestigious projects with the least deadline heat. Both of those guys woulda, shoulda, coulda been on that Brian Bolliner, Art Adams kick. Look at you. You're Rob. You're ahead of the game here. You're thinking just like Frank. Just give them some annuals or a miniseries a year. Treat it like an event and let them fill the time with the rest of with covers. Give them an arc of New Teen Titans to maintain the heat instead of a cold bucket of water that was at the Ed Barreto run. Jerome K. Moore was the kind of artist that could have even made a humbug like me want to read friggin' Major Victory book. I'm looking at that proposal art with the Trigger Scratch Terror stamp, and I want you to take my money. Then Frank says about Armageddon 2001, he goes, I like Monarch? With a question mark. The basic premise of Armageddon 2001 was really cool. Yeah, even if I don't like either of the proposed identity reveals, because I like Captain Atom too much, and I respect Hawk too little. It probably should have been Ronnie Raymond, am I right? That guy had nothing else to offer, obviously. I know Monarch's mostly a Doctor Doom knockoff as used, but had no discernible personality beyond Evil Tyrant. But I feel like the alternate future time travel angle gives it a special flavor. Consistently lousy utilization of a promising premise, the Cobra of Cronal villains. Given how little an interest I have in Dan Jurgens' work, it says a lot that I still root for Monarch. You know, Frank, I agree with you. Like, Monarch as a concept is interesting. His first appearances are interesting, and then they've never done it right since.
At this point, David S. Gutierrez popped in with, are you okay? No. The answer is no.
Let's see. And Frank, another part I got here is, I always associate David A. Williams with early Image, mostly due to my first conscious awareness of him being on Supreme Glory Days microseries and various pinups and covers for them. Even then, he was doing retro stuff, so it shouldn't surprise me that he actually got his start in the majors on the Son of Vulcan entry in the early issues of Impact's Jaguar. We've seen a fair amount of him in Who's Who already, but he'll have a bigger impact going forward. He's never seemed to get a lot of traction in the industry, but which is damn shame because he still is still in it decades on. I've got a painting by him of one of my own characters, and it's exquisite and fills me with joy. Yeah, Rob, you and I have been cheerleading almost every David A. Williams entry. We've really, really liked it. Then, believe it or not, we're finally wrapping up Frank here, folks, and I'm going to have to take a drink of water in a minute. He says about Ambush Bug. Ambush Bug will always be the funnier, ballsier, and more relevant than Deadpool, who just took the most pleasing fanboy elements from Irving Schwab and Lobo. Most of the text gags are just taken directly from various Ambush Bug appearances, merely compiled here. And then Frank says, in pure word count, this has to be my top Who's Who manifesto comments of all time. Going out with a bang indeed. It's not like I'll be able to generate this much commentary on Legion acronym, acronym Legion Recruits 93 in the year 2025. All right, Frank, suck it. We made it in 2022, not 2025. So there we go. We beat you by 3 years, buddy.
Reading that was that like the scene with Shelley Duvall in The Shining, where she finally sees what Jack Nicholson's been typing. It's okay. Let's move on.
Frank knows we love him.
Joe Cabrera. I'm sorry, Joe. Nothing can follow that. But Joe Cabrera, Rob, you are my podcaster of the week for calling out the overrated art of Tim Sale. Wow, I really struck a chord. Don't get me wrong. I'm all for art styles other than the typical superhero style getting out there, but this ain't it for me. Thin lines, two big old black dots for eyes, and those eyes are so far apart, everyone looks like a flounder. Can you tell this stuff didn't do it for me? Again, you know what? I said some nasty things about Tim Sale, like about, well, that was like an hour ago before Shag started reading Frank's comments. And I think I'm already regret. I don't mean to be so mean. I really don't. I never want to knock another artist because I've done a lot of lousy work in my life, and I wouldn't, you know. So I think he's obviously developed into a fan favorite, and good for him. And people love his work. I will just say that initial piece again, not for my taste. And I'm glad other people. I'm not the only person that thought that.
No, I think that's fair. I mean, there's no arguing that Challengers the Unknown piece is awful. I mean, it's fair to say it's not a good piece of art that's going to attract anyone to the book. Now, Tim Sale's an artist. I'll stand up for Daredevil Yellow every day.
Right. It looks great. He's done a lot of important work. So, okay. Yeah. Got it.
All right. Edwin Billiott. I'm sorry, Edwin. I'm sure I mispronounced that. I apologize. He says, Shag and Rob, today is Saturday, June 19th, 2021. And I'm just finishing listening to the last episode of Who's Who, featuring issue 16 of the Loose Leaf Edition. And I was surprised to hear you guys read my iTunes and Apple podcast review from back in May of this year. Well, there you go, Edwin. We live to serve. He says, it only took me a month to go through all of the episodes. Crazy. He says, I have the advantage of early retirement to spend my time listening to 9 years of podcasts and about a 30-year-old series. Glad to be part of the family. Thanks for the great podcast and all the hard work and love you guys put into it. I think I'm going to next start with your original Firewater podcast with number one and see where that takes me.
Don't do it. The people. Don't do that.
Please. As much as Fire and Water built Rob and I's quote-unquote friendship and it was the foundation of this network, that is so schizophrenic because it starts with us covering New 52 books, and then we go to classic books, and then by the end, we both kind of hate Firestorm and Aquaman.
Yeah, don't do that, Edwin.
It's not a healthy process.
I know we're 6 months late to this comment, but please don't do that. And then I guess the last comment, we have Jeff Tischer again. And he mentions a few things, and he says, Catwoman, I will never understand the need to give Catwoman's costume a tail. It makes zero sense from so many standpoints. So it's part of a costume, not a part of her. It's not like she can control it like a real tail. Yeah, that's true. It just gives people a chance to grab her and throw her or whatever. Yeah, it doesn't make any sense.
Right. I mean, it's something to trip over, too. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. All right, folks, so this is the part of the show where we are going to thank everyone who shared Who's Who on their social media timeline, Facebook and Twitter. It is a long list of names. I get it. It's like a phone book. But we just want to recognize each of the people who helps to promote the show. And each and every one of you folks are an important part of the Who's Who community, and we appreciate you. Now, I got to apologize in advance if I miss anyone. It is surprisingly difficult to identify old tweets and shares from about a year ago. So there is, I did have some difficulty tracking down some tweets and things like that. So if I did miss your name, I apologize. It is just the passage of time, not anything intentional. So our thanks go out to
Al Girding, Andre TFG, Andrew Lorenz, Between the Pages Blog, Billy Delicious, Captain Freakout, Psychedelic Radio, Chris A. Field, Otherverse Games, Chris Franklin, Chris Lewis, Chris Lydon, Chuck Rodriguez, Coffee and Comics, Dob Creative, Dale Russell, Daniel Ulrich, Dave's Comic Heroes Blog, David S. Gutierrez, Days of High Adventure Podcast, Dr. Ange, Dr. G. Nerdologist, Dr. Pop Culture BGSU, Dylan Knows, Ed Moore, Eldon Edwards, Fan Film Fridays Podcast, Green Lantern HG, Gus Casals, Human Flycast, Into the Weird, Isamu Yukinori, It's Your Man, a comic book discussion podcast, It's Plastic Man, J. Jones Goldstein, Jeffrey Brown, Jim Bal, John Dredge, Justice Trek, Connell, Lizanne Oswald,
Long Box of Darkness, Mark Lax, Marcus Connor, Max Romero, Max Traver, Michael Kramer, Michael O'Brien, Mick Jameson, Mike Dinas, Namiko Yukinori, Outsiders, Batman and the Outsiders Podcast, Paul Keehan, Prairie Justice, a Greg Saunders Vigilante Podcast, Randy Caldwell, Relatively Geeky Podcast Network, Ren Chandler, Robert Lewis, Roger Preeb, Rolled Spine Podcast, Scott X, Sean M. Myers, Simper, Siskoid, Slangward Scott, Star Rocket Radio, Steve Gibbons, Stop, Let's Team Up, a comic podcast, Symbol Pending, Tan Man Gelling, Teen Titan Screens, Telly Chavalis, The Bat Pod, The Mirror Factory, Tim Price, Wacky Bronze / Silver Comic Book Villains, Warlock Thanos Podcast, Weird Warriors Podcast, Will Hughes, and Willie Yarbrough. Woof! Thank you so much, everyone. Again, if I missed anyone, I sincerely apologize. Ah, so there we go, Rob.
Whew. Wow. That was an epic show.
It was. It really was. Now, folks, go out to our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. We will post some of the images from this issue. Not a lot. I will include that Darth Vader pic just to show you that you can see the combination there of Lord Satanus. And then next time when we tackle a Who's Who issue, it will be Update 93, number 2, featuring characters like
Atomic Skull,
Dark Stars,
Justice Society of America,
Guy Gardner,
Vigilante, the third.
Bloodwind.
Doomsday.
The Ray.
Lex Luthor, the second.
You got to say that with an Australian accent.
I really don't.
Okay. Team Titans.
And many, many more.
All right, folks. So that's going to do it. Thank you so much for listening. We had a blast. It's been a long time coming. This was super fun. So with that, I think we just say goodbye. So until next time.
Who's next?
Aquaman and Superman, Animal Man and Plastic Man, Firestorm and Nuclear Man, Batman and Hawkman, 2D Man and Hour Man.
Who are all these people, man?
They're all part of the DC. Who's who? Ultra Boy and Booster Gold, Lightning Lass and Hippolyta, Phantom Stranger, Etrick and Irisian, Woolly Winks.
Hey, hey, hey.
What?
What about that one guy?
What guy?
Mr. Pretzel, Mr. Lipstick, Mr. Mitzelfuzzle?
Mr. Mitzi's Pitlick?
Yeah, him.
He's also part of the DC. Who's who?
Aw, man. We forgot Slipknot.
Friends, brothers, men of Gotham, I have funded you. I've protected you. I've scratched your backs and kept you out of jail. Well, now it's time to say thank you. You don't mess with Roman Sionis!